morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Friday, December 9th, 2005. I'm Becca Bartleson.
And I'm Chris Andre.
Coming up on the KBOO Morning News, a federal class action lawsuit was filed seeking to improve the conditions of an Oregon State Hospital in Salem. The Great Lakes are nearing an ecological breakdown, and a suicide bomb attack in Bangladesh kills 8. Today's Portland area weather, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 30s to mid 40s. Tonight, clear, lows 25 to 30.
Like a bank without $20 bills, the Oregon Food Bank is low on pasta, stew, cereal, and almost anything you can eat. The Oregon Food Bank takes in food from farmers, retailers, individuals, government programs, and more, then distributes it to 20 regional food banks, which pass it on to nearly 900 local hunger relief agencies in Oregon and Clark County, Washington. Last year, the food bank's network distributed 751,000 emergency food boxes and helped serve 4 million meals at soup kitchens and shelters. The bank collected and bought nearly 1 million pounds less food from July through October than a year earlier. Officials say donations from individuals and groceries are rising, but can't recover from losses caused by hurricanes and changes in how the food industry handles damaged products. The drop in goods comes as temperatures plunge, and some families must choose between heat, food, or a very little bit of both.
A federal class action lawsuit filed yesterday seeks a court order forcing the state to improve the conditions at the Oregon State Hospital in Salem. The suit is seeking to boost staffing levels, upgrade treatment, and safeguard hundreds of mental patients at the embattled hospital. The Oregon Advocacy Center alleges that state officials have failed to fix chronic problems that have produced unsafe conditions in the forensic psychiatric program. Officials for the state and advocacy group said that they expect a swift court hearing, possibly within 1 month. The lawsuit alleges that patients have been injured, abused, and neglected on poorly staffed, cramped, violence-prone wards. Most of the forensic patients at the hospital were judged guilty except for insanity of crimes, ranging from misdemeanors to murders. The lawsuit blames state officials for failing to take action to address severe overcrowding and understaffing. Kevin Neely, a spokesman for the State Department of Justice, said the lawsuit was a disappointing development after months of settlement negotiations between the state and the advocacy group. The lawsuit comes as mental health workers work on plans for replacing the hospital, perhaps in 5 years or later.
Two defense contractors at the center of ex-Representative Randy Duke Cunningham's bribery case also spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to curry favor with other influential lawmakers. One contractor, Brent Wilkes, provided private jet flights to lawmakers, including Roy Blunt, who is serving as majority leader while Tom DeLay fights his money laundering charges in Texas. Wilkes also raised at least $100,000 for President Bush's 2004 re-election bid and donated more than $70,000 to Arnold Schwarzenegger. Schwarzenegger turned around and appointed Wilkes to two state boards. There's no indication that these donations were improper. Other lawmakers who benefited from Wilkes' generosity include Tom DeLay himself, who got $70,000, House Armed Services Committee Chairman Duncan Hunter, House Appropriations Committee Chairman Jerry Lewis, and Catherine Harris. Keith Ashdown of Taxpayers for Common Sense said that Wilkes and his partner were expert at greasing the wheels of the legislative machine. He said, "They knew who and when to give money to, and it really gave them free rein over taxpayer-funded defense contractors."
Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa has appointed business leader Estela Lopez as executive director of the city's Homeless Services Authority Board, which distributes funds to homeless organizations. FSRN's Leilano Albano reports from Los Angeles.
Estela Lopez currently heads the Central City East Association, an organization that represents business and property owners in downtown's Skid Row district. Central City East had come under fire in recent years for its treatment of homeless people. The organization, which provides security and other services for property owners, was sued by the ACLU in 1999 for allegedly violating the civil rights of transients after they confiscated their belongings. According to ACLU records, security guards for the CCEA took away a disabled person's crutches for refusing to consent to having his picture taken, while another guard threatened to discard a man's prescription medicine. Pete White is the director of the Community Action Network, a homeless advocacy organization.
Ms. Lopez's role in LASA will be looked upon by community residents with particular scrutiny, because we know from the past that the goal of this organization was to drive homeless and poor individuals out of this community.
For FSRN, this is Leilani Albano in Los Angeles.
Stresses from polluted rivers and invasive species threaten to trigger an ecological breakdown in the Great Lakes, this according to Reuters. 75 scientists who study the world's largest collective body of fresh water released their report on the myriad problems that need cleanup or restoration. A task force comprising federal agencies, Congress, local government officials, and regional Indian tribes is scheduled to release its much-anticipated final plan for preserving the Great Lakes. The task force's preliminary report recommended $20 billion in federal, state, and private funding over 15 years. The money would go to upgrade antiquated municipal sewer systems, restore 500,000 acres of wetlands, clean polluted harbors and bays, and pay for other efforts. But a federal oversight group subsequently suggested to the White House that the budget was too tight to allow additional funding. According to the Government Accountability Office, federal spending on Great Lakes cleanup over the past decade was just $800 million. Shoreline pollution that fouls Great Lakes beaches is extending into the middle of some of the five Great Lakes. Sudden drops in oxygen levels in the water threaten native species, and native fish have been crowded out by invasive species that have changed the character of the lakes.
At least one passenger aboard American Airlines Flight 924 maintains the federal air marshals were a little too quick on the draw when they shot and killed Rigoberto Alpizar. John McCallney, a 44-year-old construction worker from Sebastian, Florida, said, "I don't think they needed to use deadly force with the guy. He was getting off the plane." McCallney also maintains that Alpizar never mentioned having a bomb. McCallney described Alpizar as carrying a big backpack and wearing a fanny pack in front. He said it would have been impossible for Alpizar to lie flat on the floor of the plane, as marshals ordered him to do, with the fanny pack on. By the time Alpizar made it to the front of the airplane, the crew had ordered the rest of the passengers to get down between the seats. McCallney said he tried to see what was happening just in case he needed to take evasive action. He says, "I was on the phone with my brother. Somebody came down the aisle and put a shotgun to the back of my head and said, 'Put your hands on the seat in front of you.' I got my cell phone karate chopped out of my hand. Then I realized it was an official." McCallney said he saw Alpizar before the flight and is absolutely stunned by what unfolded on the airplane. He said he saw Alpizar eating a sandwich in the boarding area before getting on the plane. "He looked normal at the time," McCallney says. "He thinks the whole thing was a mistake. I don't believe he should be dead right now."
Congress in a late session, gift-giving move, but until the House and Senate reconcile competing tax relief bills, it will be hard to tell whether the big winners will be the middle class or the rich or both. The two chambers face tricky negotiations on two very different versions of a tax cut called for months ago, and it isn't clear how soon this will be resolved. The House voted 234 to 197 to pass its tax cut Thursday. The bill focuses on reduced tax rates for capital gains and dividends, preserving the 15% tax rate for investment income in 2009 and 2010 that otherwise will evaporate at the end of 2008. It will also preserve tax cuts scheduled to expire in just a few weeks, including popular deductions for state and local sales taxes and tuition, along with a tax credit for low-income savers. The Senate's version of the bill, passed last month, focuses instead on the alternative minimum tax. Their bill seeks to temporarily hold back the tax next year when it could hit more than 17 million individuals and families with higher taxes. The alternative minimum tax was invented to prevent the wealthy from completely avoiding taxation. Senate GOP leaders tried to use their bill to keep tax cuts for investors in place for at least one extra year. The effort died in the Senate Finance Committee, with a key senator, moderate Republican Olympia Snowe of Maine, withheld her support. The Senate's GOP leaders vow that the final version of the tax cut would continue reduced tax rates for capital gains and dividends. They face virtually united opposition from Democrats, who say the alternative minimum tax should be the top priority right now, as well as lingering hesitancy among some moderate Republicans. Lawmakers can complete their work in the spring if they run out of time this year, and they can make any expired tax cuts retroactive to the beginning of the year.
Lawyers for Stanley Tookie Williams pleaded for his life before Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger yesterday, 5 days before he is scheduled to be executed. Prosecutors in Thursday's closed-door clemency hearing, however, told Schwarzenegger that Williams deserves death for 4 shotgun murders in 1979. Schwarzenegger gave each side about 30 minutes to present their cases. He has said it will be a difficult decision, which he can make at any point until the moment of execution. The governor did not make a final decision at yesterday's hearings.
The House Judiciary Committee approved an anti-immigration measure that will make it easier to deport immigrants and take steps towards militarizing the border. Yet the bill does nothing to address the status of some 11 million undocumented immigrants living and working in the U.S. FSRN's Mitch Jezerich reports from Capitol Hill.
Mr. Chairman, there are 23 ayes and 15 noes.
And the motion to report the bill favorably as amended is agreed to.
With that, a Republican proposal to toughen immigration laws and enforcements took a big step forward in making undocumented immigrants criminals by turning any immigration violation into a crime. Tracy Hong is with the National Asian Pacific American Legal Consortium.
An F-1 student who is in the United States to go to a university or a college drops a class because he finds that he has, he's taken one too many classes and drops below the full course load needed. That person has all of a sudden become an aggravated felon.
The measure also attempts to make it harder for employers to hire undocumented immigrants. It would require all employers to verify the legal status of all of their workers. Maria Elena Encapi is with the National Immigration Law Center.
It's going to push undocumented immigrants into the underground cash economy for exploitation because there's no path to citizenship or a means of getting work authorization under this bill.
The measure does not address, however, what to do with the some 11 million undocumented immigrants already living in the United States, but it would call for local law enforcement to enact immigration laws upon them. James Sensenbrenner is a Republican chair of the House Judiciary Committee.
Amnesty only encourages more people to come to the United States illegally, whether it's illegal entry under the fence or illegal entry and then overstaying a visa.
But one Republican, Jeff Flake of Arizona, says it's unrealistic to think that they'll all be deported.
For those who say, well, let's just pretend that they're not here, let's keep them in the shadows, that's more of an amnesty than anything,
right,
in my view. To pretend that they're not here and say, let's just, I'll count to 100, and if you can go back to your home country and apply from there, then we're not going to give you amnesty. That's simply wrong, and we shouldn't be engaging in that charade.
The entire House will vote on the immigration bill next week. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News, The Capitol.
U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says he has no plans to retire from the post more than 2.5 years into the conflict. The New York Daily News reported that Gordon England, the number two official at the Pentagon, was inside contender to replace Rumsfeld. Senator Joe Lieberman is also a possibility. The Defense Department said Rumsfeld held an early morning meeting at the Pentagon yesterday with Lieberman. The senator's views of the Iraq War stand in stark contrast with those of many other Democrats. Rumsfeld has been criticized for the conduct of the war. Massachusetts Senators Edward Kennedy and John Kerry are demanding his resignation. Rumsfeld also has had frosty relations even with fellow Republicans in Congress.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld also said yesterday he expects some 20,000 U.S. troops to return home from Iraq after next week's elections. He suggested that some of the remaining 137,000 forces could pull out next year. The Pentagon chief also said he believed the White House and Senator John McCain would end up working something out during negotiations over legislation standardizing interrogation techniques and banning mistreatment of foreign terrorism suspects in U.S. custody. Congressional bargainers were nearing completion of a defense bill that's expected to include the McCain provisions. Aides said votes on the measure could come next week. Still, GOP leaders haven't blessed the bill because they are waiting for the result of the White House's negotiations with McCain. Rumsfeld made his comments between closed-door meetings on Capitol Hill with House members. It's part of an effort by the Bush administration to communicate better with Congress about the war.
Republican congressional negotiators announced a White House-backed deal yesterday to extend the USA Patriot Act. The opponents said it did not satisfy their civil liberties concerns. This according to Reuters. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Arlen Specter acknowledged the compromise was not perfect. Some Senate Republicans and Democrats were quick to say the compromise did not go far enough in improving the Patriot Act. Specter said the Senate and House of Representatives would vote next week on extending the law, which otherwise would expire on December 31st. Four senior liberal Democrats said if the latest compromise could not be changed more to their liking by the deadline, Congress should pass a 90-day extension of the current law to give lawmakers more time. Specter said a key promise worked out by House and Senate negotiators was a four-year extension of some of the most controversial provisions that raise civil liberties concerns. The House has been seeking a 10-year extension. The four-year limit would be on rules for moving roving wiretaps of suspects and court orders for records from businesses, libraries, bookstores, and others in intelligent cases.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan defended his High Commissioner for Human Rights, Louise Arbour, yesterday after U.S. Ambassador John Bolton rebuked her for criticizing the U.S. stance on torture. This according to Reuters. Annan wants to take up the matter with Bolton as soon as possible. This reveals a rare public expression of displeasure with a UN ambassador. High Commissioner Louise Arbour on Wednesday said the U.S.-led war on terror undermined the global ban on torture. Bolton called the criticism inappropriate and illegitimate. Arbour avoided directly naming the United States in her statement and press conference commemorating Human Rights Day, but she criticized two practices that applied to the United States, holding prisoners in secret detention centers and rendering suspects to third countries without independent oversight. Annan and Bolton have recently differed over the UN budget. Bolton has insisted management reforms be approved by the General Assembly before the United States would agree to a new two-year budget. Annan says Bolton's suggestions for an interim 3- or 4-month budget would create a severe cash flow shortage.
After having completed 4 months of training with the U.S. Marines, a battalion of 550 Georgian soldiers is now to be deployed to Iraq. The operation is in step with Georgia's strategic alliance with the U.S. and its ambitions to join NATO. However, as FSRN's Guy Deegan reports, critics say that with a high rate of unemployment and continued corruption, the media is under pressure to critique the government and to ignore domestic reforms which require greater attention.
As many as 8 voters were killed in clashes with police in Egypt yesterday. Hundreds were wounded. President Hosni Mubarak's ruling party won a 2/3 majority of parliament. The Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamist group, won 88 of parliament's 444 seats. The Brotherhood is officially a banned organization. Its candidates run as independents. Secular opposition candidates also picked up a handful of seats. But during the final phase of Egypt's month-long election, many supporters of opposition candidates were unable to vote. The polling station in Omar Marzouk's village, north of Cairo, was surrounded by police. They're forbidding people from voting.
Sorry, that was not the story that we just announced. Well, now I'll try to get that for you.
The approval rating of Georgia's Mikhail Saakashvili may be over 70%, but national unemployment is widely believed to be as high, if not higher. And while the National Police Force has undergone reforms, Amnesty International says that the use of torture by Georgia's police is still a problem, and the government should keep the eradication of torture and ill treatment as a priority. While insisting that the police force is improving, Foreign Minister Gelo Beshuavili concedes that ill treatment of people by police could still be occurring.
We are not saying that there are no cases, but we need to treat it on a case-by-case basis. There are not a massive human rights violations in Georgia anymore.
The Georgian government has also stressed that within the past 2 years it has reduced corruption, particularly at a low level of administration. However, critics argue that the government exceeds the law in order to get things done, often in the name of reform. Mark Mullen is the chairman of Transparency International in Georgia. He notes that the $295 million of US funding that Georgia will soon receive through the Millennium Challenge account is an example of where the government is not setting a good example of transparent administration.
We worry that, somehow, because of, there don't seem to be very strict transparency provisions on it, and because the method by which Washington and Millennium Challenge Georgia are making decisions between themselves with nobody else discussing it, that that a lot of that money might get lost.
Of perhaps greater concern is legal reform and the guaranteeing of independence of Georgia's courts. Several judges recently spoke out about being coerced into resigning by the government. It's widely known that some judges may have been tainted by corruption during the Shevardnadze era. But Anna Dolitsa, chair of the Young Georgian Lawyers Association, says that corrupt judges should be prosecuted in accordance with the law and not just asked to quietly resign.
Judges of the Supreme Court, the top court in the country, are being threatened, are being sabotaged, and their rights are being violated. What can we do? Whether will our rights be protected by this court, by this kind of courts? That's why I think a public debate, an acute one sometimes, a critical one, is totally necessary, because only through public discussions can the government get the plethora of ideas of how to go forward with the serious questions that it's confronted with.
Dolitsa fears that such a public debate is not occurring in Georgia because the media is reluctant to criticize the government. Akaki Gogashvili agrees. An investigative journalist with Rustavi 2 Television's 60 Minutes, Gogashvili has a reputation for breaking big stories. However, since the election of the Saakashvili government, his team continues to produce stories, but the program is no longer broadcast. Gogashvili believes that because the station supported Saakashvili in the revolution, it does not want to offend the government. He argues that there is a culture of self-censorship in Georgia, and journalists are still being intimidated.
I know several of them who have been beaten. The government controls the situation. They just ban the journalists who are dangerous, who are not controllable from access to the public, and they can contain them, so to say.
With winter fast approaching, Georgia has won praise from the U.S. government for its financial preparation to meet the season's high energy costs. Dependency on Russia for energy still poses a big problem for Georgia. But while Georgians hope they'll have adequate light and heating over the winter, 2 years after their Rose Revolution, the high expectations for long-term reforms are now beginning to cool. In Tbilisi, Georgia, this is Guy Deegan for Free Speech Radio News.
In Bangladesh, a suicide bomb attack killed at least 8 people and wounded more than 50. It's the latest in a series of deadly blasts blamed on militants seeking Islamic rule in that country. Police said 2 bombs exploded on a crowded street within the space of a few minutes during the morning rush hour in Nakrona. No one claimed responsibility for the blasts, but police blamed Islamist suicide bombers fighting for the introduction of Sharia law in the mainly Muslim democracy. Police said they found a would-be suicide bomber among the wounded with an unexploded bomb strapped to his body. Another suicide bomber was believed to be among the dead. Yesterday's deaths took the number of people killed by suspected suicide bombers to 28 in 3 weeks. Bangladesh has been hit by a wave of bomb attacks since August. The government is blaming the violence on militants from banned groups. This, according to Reuters.
A suicide bomber detonated explosives yesterday inside a packed bus bound for a southern Shiite city, killing 32 people and wounding 44. The blast pushed the 3-day death toll from suicide attacks in the capital of Iraq to at least 75. Yesterday's suicide attack occurred as the bus was pulling away from East Baghdad's Nadhat station bound for Nasiriyah, 200 miles to the south. A man carrying a bag suddenly jumped on the vehicle through the open door, apparently waiting until the last moment to board to avoid security checks. Meanwhile, a statement posted on the internet in the name of the Islamic Army in Iraq claimed to have killed an American hostage. The statement did not name him or provide photos, but the group earlier identified its captive as Ronald Allen Schultz and threatened to kill him unless all prisoners in Iraq were released.
Worldwide, Muslim leaders have agreed to set up a fund for development and emergency relief for those in need among the world's billion Muslims. They did not say how they would raise the money. They also agreed on a 10-year plan to increase trade between Muslims and to curb religious extremism, which they said has driven the Islamic world into crisis. The organization of Islamic Conference members range from Gulf Arab states flush with cash from high oil prices to poor African and Asian nations such as Niger and Bangladesh. Leaders agreed to set up a fund for disaster relief and development and called for intra-Muslim trade to be raised to 20% from 13% within 10 years. But they failed to say how they intended to achieve their goals. A senior delegate at the talk said the leaders could not agree on how to finance the fund, given the huge disparity of wealth among OIC members. This according to Al Jazeera.
Kenya's president, Mwai Kibaki, faced a political crisis yesterday after several ministers refused to take up posts in his new cabinet. This according to The Telegraph. Kibaki sacked his entire team and postponed the reopening of parliament after losing a key referendum 2 weeks ago. His new lineup was packed with sycophantic loyalists and lacked the popular politicians who opposed him during the vote on a draft, new constitution, that would have entrenched his powers. Yesterday, Kibaki's nominees for the health, local government, and environment portfolios refused to accept their appointments. Several junior ministers also jumped ship, claiming the cabinet of cronies was an insult to Kenyans. Those remaining are largely from the president's dominant Kikuyu tribe and looking increasingly isolated with the opposition, boosted by referendum success.
There's been yet another disastrous explosion in a mine in China. According to the China Daily, carbon monoxide 100 times above safety levels is hampering efforts to rescue 32 miners trapped in a coal mine in North China's Hebei province. Officials say the chances for survival for those still underground were slim. The death toll following the coal mine blast rose to 74 yesterday. China's mining industry is considered to be the most dangerous in the world. And this has been the KBOO Morning News for Friday, December 9th, 2005. Portland area weather. Today, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 30s to mid 40s. Tonight, clear, lows 25 to 30. Saturday, sunny, breezy, highs in the upper 30s to mid 40s. Saturday night, clear, breezy, lows 25 to 30. Sunday, mostly sunny, breezy, highs in the upper 30s to mid 40s. And Sunday night, mostly clear in the evening, then partly cloudy, lows 30 to 35. Thanks for joining us for this morning's news. The KBOO Morning Newscast was edited by Becca Bartelson and Chris Andrea. Our engineer is Kathleen Stevenson, the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Becca Bartelson.
Coming up this morning on your community radio station at 7:30, Arnie and Melody host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. The topic is the Patriot Act. They'll speak with a representative of the ACLU. At 9 on Malina's Electronic Salon, local naturopath Dr. Stephen Bailey discusses cold and flu symptoms and how to tell the difference between them. Later, Malina's speaks with Dr. Justin Frank, author of Bush on the Couch. He'll have an update on George Bush from a psychiatric perspective. We'll also hear from Michael Mead on the importance of myth in our lives. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. Would you like to help with the morning news? Cable always needs volunteers to help getting important stories like these out to listeners. Contact us at amnews@kboo.org or call 503-232-8818, extension 202. This is KBOO, your community radio station in Portland at 90.7 FM, in Corvallis at 100.7, and in the White Salmon area on K220HR at 91.9 FM. Have a great weekend.
This is Community Calendar for Friday, 12/9. The Asian Culture Appreciation Club at Mount Hood Community College will be holding their Miss Asia Pageant Holiday Dance on Friday, 12/9. Contestants representing their Asian country will compete based on talent and knowledge of their country. Also, there will be a dance, demonstrations, and lessons, followed by karaoke and dancing till midnight. Doors open at 6:30 and tickets are $10 at the door. A three-course dinner is included with the price of admission. The event will be held at the Viesta Dining Room on the Mount Hood Community College Gresham campus, located at 26000 Southeast Stark. For more info, call 503-449-4728. There's going to be a benefit for the Portland Women's Crisis Line on 12/9 from 9 p.m. to 2:30 a.m. This is a night of rock against violence, and four bands will be playing for $5. The bands are the Decliners, Other Men My Age, Old Growth, and Morgan Grace. This is going to be located at Academy, which is at the corner of Southeast 8th and Main in Portland. For more info, send an email to japhy47@hotmail.com. Tara Mathern Dance premieres Mathern's latest work, The Grammar of Regret, which explores the complexity and nature of regret through examining the structures by which we express it in language. This event will run until 12/11 from 8 to 9 p.m. at Conduit Dance, located at 918 Southwest Yamhill and Park. Tickets are $12 to $15, and this project is funded in part by the Regional Arts and Cultural Council. For more info, call 503-221-5857. The community calendar has a new email address. Please send event listing and press releases to kboonecommunitycalendar@gmail.com or drop it off at station located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Thanks for tuning in to the KBOO Community Calendar for 12/9. You're listening to KBOO member-supported independent radio in Corvallis, Hood River, and Portland.
Good morning. It's a really, really cold and bitterly cold and dark Friday morning out there. The winds are blowing, and the hounds of winter are almost upon us, my friends. And so it's a great day just to stay warm, cuddle up with a blanket and a cup of tea, and listening to your favorite community radio station. That's KBOO. That's us. And this morning, until 9 o'clock, you'll be listening to Positively Revolting Talk Radio. And I'm your host, Melody Silverwolf. My lovely co-host, Bonnie Haynes, will be joining us in just a moment. And before we dive into our topic du jour, I have an announcement. This is sort of a reminder announcement from last week, but it's very important. I wanted to remind you. I know there's a lot going on. It's easy to forget these things. Tomorrow, noon, First and Salmon, downtown, International Human Rights Day. It's not like we need, like, improvement in human rights or anything. I mean, everything's great, right? No, everything's not great. You need to turn out. It's going to be a march, and there'll be a lot of information there. And it's the fight for our right to organize unions and the fight against the WTO and the whole corporate trade agenda. And this is in response, in a way, in a forward response to a meeting in Hong Kong, which is going to begin December 13th. And in addition to tomorrow at noon at First and Salmon, a march, there's going to be an international fair trade teach-in a week from tomorrow, the 17th of December. That's from 10 to 4. It's going to be at the PSU Koinonia Center, which is at 633 Southwest Montgomery. That's on the corner, basically, of Montgomery and Broadway downtown. And a whole slew of people are endorsing it, all the usual suspects, lots of labor unions, Jobs with Justice, all those folks, and many more. And if you need more information, you can call Jobs with Justice, 503-236-5573, or you can look on their website, www.jwjpdx.org. So that's tomorrow at noon at First and Salmon. And I hope we see you there. So, getting back to the topic of our show today, we had hoped to have a guest from the ACLU, but the ACLU is so busy that they were unable to connect with us at the time that we needed them, because there's so much going on in this country. It's just mind-boggling. We hardly know where to start. The first thing, one of the most important things, unfortunately, the House and the Senate agreed yesterday to extend the Patriot Act, which is very bad news. For a number of reasons, because they have failed to address some of the, shall we say, egregious flaws of the Patriot Act as it stands. And it says, key Republicans in the House and Senate reached a White House-backed compromise yesterday to renew the broad powers granted to law enforcement agencies. And they're going to be renewing these provisions for 4 more years. How convenient, huh? And removing the most egregious parts of the bill. And it's going to involve the ability of law enforcement to gain access to a wealth of personal data, including your library records and your medical records. And they'll be allowed to conduct roving wiretaps, which may involve multiple phones, and to seek access to many of the personal records covered by the bill. It says, also extended is the power to wiretap so-called lone wolf terrorists, who may operate on their own without control from a foreign agent or a power. Now, if that isn't a scary thought. Now, let me read that again. You can wiretap so-called lone wolf terrorists who may operate on their own. Now, okay, let's look at that in the context of a news story that I saw yesterday, which I found absolutely horrifying, about the activities of environmental activists in Colorado, who've been rallying to, you know, support various causes. And the FBI has been caught red-handed examining them, keeping records on them as if they were terrorists. In fact, they claim that because it's a legitimate record-keeping activity in that case, because, after all, these groups encourage civil disobedience, such as blocking streets. And the FBI agent claimed this and said, well, you know, the Terrorism Act does say that, you know, if it's if it's, you know, infringing on other people's rights, then, you know, that makes it illegitimate. And so they're basically trying to claim that if your group calls for civil disobedience, you know, the horrible crime of, you know, blocking a street, that somehow that qualifies as a kind of a quasi-terrorism, which, of course, is ridiculous. And, I mean, what can you say about something like that, really? But, you know, all is not totally lost about the Patriot Act. There are a few people left in the Congress and the Senate who have a clue. There is a coalition of seven, count them, seven people. Ooh, woohoo! Seven people. A bipartisan group who, of course, object to the passage of the Patriot Act without without some of the more egregious parts being removed. And they are claiming that they're going to filibuster. Russ Feingold is one of the people who plans to lead that. Patrick Leahy is another one, who's the senator from Vermont. And they claim that they will filibuster if, you know, some of the most egregious parts of the Patriot Act are not removed. That's probably not going to have much of an effect, unfortunately. But early next week, the Senate will be, you know, will be finalizing this. So, you know, you might want to, for what it's worth, contact your the usual suspects, your critters and senators, and say, hey, what do you think you're doing? Do you really think that I'm going to just give up my rights without a fight like this in the name of so-called fighting terrorism? Oh, I've just learned that. Miracle of miracles. We are going to be able to have our ACLU guest later in the show, as we had hoped, so that's really good. Lots to look forward to there. But in the meantime, until that person joins us, we have a lot to talk about. There's so much more happening besides just the Patriot Act. You know, our rights are under siege, folks. This is very chilling. In addition to the Patriot Act being extended, which is very disturbing, there's a whole lot of other things going on where what's left of our right to freedom of speech is under attack. Now, this is a really interesting – there's a really interesting case being heard by the Supreme Court right now, which I think has far-reaching implications. It's ostensibly, on the face of it, it's about military recruiters' access to law schools. And that in and of itself is an important it's an important issue. And Yale University is at the center of this. But it goes far beyond, the implications of the case go far beyond just the case at hand. It's basically the case hinges on the fact that if universities ban military recruiters from their campuses, they stand to lose hundreds of millions of dollars in taxpayer subsidies. And not just subsidies that would seem to be relevant, like academic ones. All federal money that would come to that university would be cut off. For example, Yale, who is one of the big players in this case, would lose $300 million in taxpayer subsidies. And the case centers around the so-called Solomon Amendment, which was passed in 1994. It says that colleges and universities that accept federal funding must provide access for military recruiters on campus. And Yale is one of the group of universities who have made a morally based and conscience-driven decision, according to their attorney, to curb military recruiters' access. And that means that, you know, if they lose this, if they lose this case, then they would have to choose between getting anything and having free speech. And one of the things that disturbs me the most about this is that our pal Justice Roberts, the newly minted Chief Justice, has a very interesting take on this case, which I find real disturbing. He says, this is a quote from Roberts. "This is conduct. Denying access to the military recruiters," said Roberts. "It is not an exercise of free speech, and therefore it's not protected by the First Amendment." Now, I think this is very interesting because of the fact that, as we all know, free speech has been one of the components in the insistence that corporations have the right to contribute money to political campaigns, because to limit their right to do so, because after all, they are considered to be persons under the Constitution, wrongly so, but still there you have it. To limit their contributions to political campaigns would be an infringement of free speech. So in that case, corporations have been held to be speaking, so to speak, pardon the pun, when they are giving money to political campaigns. So if that is speech and not conduct, then how can Roberts say that in the case of Yale University and the other universities that their position is conduct and not speech? I think this is really disturbing. You can't have it both ways. Either it's speech or it isn't. If it's speech in the case of handing money over to a lobbyist, then it should be speech in the case of saying, in a news conference, speaking to say, no, we won't allow these people on our campus. They're not doing anything. They're simply speaking to these recruiters and saying, no, you can't come here. Go away. So I think this is really disturbing, not only the fact that the military recruiters may be allowed on campus, which is, you know, not a good thing, but it's not the end of the world. But I think the further implications are very disturbing. And, of course, there's another aspect to this case as well. The attorney for the plaintiffs in the case, Joshua Rosenkranz, who's representing the universities, he says that by being forced to host military recruiters, universities were being forced to spread a message of anti-gay discrimination. And then Rosenkranz complained that their own students didn't believe the law schools when they proclaimed their opposition to discrimination against gays. So, I mean, this is very, very complicated. But again, Justice Roberts, polluting the waters further, implied that if law schools truly wanted to be conscientious, they would be willing to give up their federal funding to show their commitment to their anti-discrimination beliefs. So now if you want to hold anti-discrimination beliefs, you're not allowed to take federal funding? What the devil is going on here? This is just outrageous. Is not even a word that covers it. The word that covers it, I can't say on the air. And that's a whole other issue that I want to get into. And then there's the issue of Mr. Stern, Howard Stern. Everyone's, shall we say, favorite or least favorite shock jock has abandoned commercial radio for Sirius. That's Sirius like the dog star, satellite radio. Because, among other reasons, first of all, he'll be making more money, and let's not forget that. But the ostensible main reason is because on satellite radio, he can say what he wants to say, because satellite radio is not regulated by the FCC in the way that broadcast or so-called terrestrial radio, earth-based radio, that's us, yes. We're a terrestrial, as opposed to an extraterrestrial station, I guess. But I think that that's very interesting, that now only people who have a lot of money are allowed to have free speech. Basically, these two cases tie together. You know, first we have Roberts saying, well, if you want to have free speech, you shouldn't take federal funding. And now people who want to be free to say what they want to say on the air, radio professionals who are, that's their whole careers based on that, are starting to abandon terrestrial radio because of that. So basically, if you got money, you have rights in America. If you don't, move along. Go somewhere else. Why don't you go back to Russia?
I think that would be the phrase, you know, speech is free for those that can afford it.
Yes. Well, it used to be like the press is free for those who have one. But, you know, I guess now it's not enough to have lips. You have to have money to wave in front of them while you're talking.
Yes.
And we're joined by my lovely co-host, who apparently was only waiting for her coffee to be lucid enough to
speak
on the air.
No. No, I cannot even tell you. Well, again, as I heard you say earlier,
she's pulled off a miracle, gotten
our
guest.
You know, we have secured once again Lisa Graves, who is the senior counsel for legislative strategy for the Washington D.C. office of the ACLU, and she will be joining us at 8:30.
In the meantime,
we have
a lot to talk about.
You know, there is a whole lot to talk about, as Melody's been elucidating too. I was just astonished by what a big news day yesterday was. And with the sort of late breaking mid-afternoon news of the passage of the reauthorization out of the committee for the Patriot Act, it's really pertinent, it's really important that we be aware of what's going on, that we share information and we share it well, and that we, you know, engage people who have not yet been engaged to get engaged now. There's also, I wanted to mention, apparently, a fairly major roundup of some folks who are apparently are being subpoenaed in a grand jury or several grand juries. There looks like there were nationwide arrests and or subpoenas handed out yesterday looking at several alleged arsons in Oregon and Washington in 98 through 2004 or something like that. And, you know, a few people from Portland were subpoenaed, not arrested. But people have been arrested again throughout the country in what really looks like, well, it's admittedly a culmination of a long-term surveillance plan. And that's something we need to pay attention to.
And it goes right along with that thing I was talking about from Colorado.
It does.
It's happening all over. And,
it
you know,
indeed.
On the flimsiest of pretexts, the FBI is keeping tabs. I didn't tell you the rest of the story, which was that they've been not only tracking this group, but they've also been doing that time-honored technique of going around for blocks around when they have a meeting and writing down the license plates of all the cars parked for blocks, several block radius.
So God forbid your Aunt Gladys lived next to
right,
the
or
hall.
You were at the the coffee shop next door having a bagel or something.
Well, and you know, even given that, the fact that your license plate is being reported because you're going to a meeting to talk about, you know, peace and
excuse
ending
me?
War and stuff is like, how chilling is that?
It's completely.
I mean, McCarthy
totally against the intents
so
of the founders of this country.
Happy at this
yes.
moment, McCarthy on high is like smiling. Okay, that's not the world we want to create around us. So we really need again to organize,
yes,
to talk to each other, to inform each other. And I know Melody had mentioned before one opportunity to do that. I want to mention it again, and that is the march and rally tomorrow. Saying no to the WTO and yes to the right to organize, taking to the streets for labor solidarity, ecological stability, food sovereignty, genetic autonomy, human and indigenous rights, universal dignity, peace, and freedom. Who
they
could
forgot,
argue?
They forgot common sense.
You know.
I mean, who in their right mind would be for the WTO unless they were
it
a wealthy industrialist, you know?
Noon, December 10th. That's noon, December 10th. Noon, tomorrow. That would be at the World Trade Center downtown. First and Salmon. Noon, tomorrow, First and Salmon. Portland.
Not coincidentally, also the address of the office of our favorite Senator, Gordo Smith.
Well, yeah, there's that. So that's First and Salmon, noon tomorrow. WTO gathering of folks. It's a day of solidarity as the WTO.
Yes, do wear pink if you can.
Needs to do their nefarious deeds. So, with that in mind, 503-231-8187 is our phone number. Please feel free to join us on the air this morning. I'm sure you've noticed some of these things as well. What's on your mind? How do you propose to increase people's awareness of this problem? What do you propose to do to spread the information and get people motivated to take right action? What do you do?
Well, I just think that free speech is so threatened in our country in every way. I mean, ask yourself, really, where do you have free speech besides, you know, in your home with your friends? You can't speak freely at work in many workplaces. You can't speak freely on the air. You can't speak freely politically if you have radical views without jeopardizing your status in the community. It's very disturbing. But apparently, also, you can't speak freely in New Mexico. Now, I follow this trend pretty closely. And this is about the sixth thing, at least, that I can recall specifically coming out of New Mexico. There's been all kinds of one of the things that happened in New Mexico a year or two ago was the art contest where students drew anti-war posters for the art contest in school, and they were ripped down by the teacher. You surely remember that. And there's been all kinds of cases. And New Mexico apparently is a hotbed of anti-free speech teaching. I don't really know what the heck is wrong with public schools in New Mexico, but something terribly wrong is going on there. So here's the latest. The civil rights new groups in New Mexico are denouncing a high school contest soliciting anti-gay, anti-choice student essays. This happened just in late November in Farmington. The ACLU and other groups are protesting an essay contest at Farmington's Piedra Vista High School that asks students to explain why preserving marriage between men and women is vital to society and why unborn children must merit respect and protection. The ACLU of New Mexico, Equality New Mexico, and NARAL Pro-Choice New Mexico said the contest violates state regulations banning sexual orientation discrimination by teachers. They also object to the ideological slant of an assignment in a public school. And apparently, the assignment was part of an essay contest sponsored by United Families International, which is a nonprofit whose primary mission is to, quote, strengthen the family by promoting marriage between one man and one woman and the protection of human life, including unborn children. Now, why public schools are even participating in an essay contest sponsored by a right-wing, anti-choice, anti-gay group, it just boggles my mind. But this kind of thing is happening everywhere. Where do we have free speech?
The lines of what's the state's and what's private are being really blurred in free speech interests elsewhere. And there's the Michigan case that Melody actually made me aware of yesterday.
Scary, isn't it?
Where a fellow had been arrested for... it was a drug charge. He was deferred to treatment, right?
Christian treatment.
And I'm trying to remember the word when you take someone out of the system. Diversion. That's the word I'm looking for. He was diverted.
Court-ordered diversion.
To a treatment program.
And he was okay with it, even though it was Christian. He said, I'll do that. You know,
right.
Because he's a Catholic.
And, in fact, it was a Pentecostal organization that ran this so-called treatment program. And they told him that in order to pass out of the treatment program, he would have to convert.
He had to renounce his religion was, quote-unquote, witchcraft, and that he had to, if he didn't become Pentecostal, that they were going to send him to jail.
His rosary was not acceptable, and the like. Now, this was a court-ordered diversion program. You know, after several months, I believe it was 6 months, he, said that this was not acceptable to him, and he, requested something else be done. He was given jail time. He was given also boot camp.
Yes, he was indeed sent to jail. And this is for a minor drug offense.
Because he would not renounce his faith. The ACLU is taking up that case.
Yes, they are.
So I think it goes, again, part and parcel with what we're seeing, you know, sort of this national trend to curtail civil rights, to change the essence of free speech, to change the essence of freedom of assembly, to change the essence of privacy. And it's being done, well, first with a huge shindig, and now, you know, just sort of things normalizing, as it were. And as things, quote, normalize, you know, people are just supposed to accept these changes. You know, they're no longer shocking, right? This is the way things have been for the last several years. So it's time, in fact, to, again, awaken the conscience and say these things are shocking. The Patriot Act cannot be reauthorized. We cannot make permanent provisions of this extraordinarily draconian bill or law. Act, that was passed in such haste without anyone having read it.
It's the 20th century.
So we have, again, a lot to talk about. I want to make sure everyone knows. It's 8 o'clock in the morning, and you are listening to KBOO-FM Portland. I'm Ani.
I'm Melody.
We are here, again, entertaining your calls. Someone's about to join us, 503-231-8187, if you'd like to join us, too. And at 8:30, just want to let folks know, we will be talking with Lisa Graves from the ACLU Washington, D.C. office. She is the Senior Counsel for Legislative Strategy. So we can talk with her about the reauthorization of the Patriot Act and what we can do next legislatively. How that process goes from this point on. And good morning to you. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My house is about 39 degrees.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. My heat kicked on last night. It was turned down to 50.
The phone. I forgot to put mittens on. My dog's crushed up against me trying to get warm.
Uh-huh. Mom, please.
All the animals are crowding around me. I called last week. My wood stove's in another room.
Uh-huh.
So this kitchen area never gets heated. And he put me on hold for like 45 minutes, and I realized that I'd been disconnected.
Oh, no. And you're sitting in there shivering.
Oh, insult to injury.
It was so funny. I wasn't upset at all because I know it's easy to disconnect people.
My dear, what's on your mind this
week? Well, I'm calling because I was really irritated when I heard on the news that they had been following and investigating people who had destroyed property. Because basically we can't protest anymore. We get maced and rubber bullets shot and at us, and people, wonderful people like the lady who tried to protect the redwoods had a bomb put under her seat.
Judy Berry.
I mean, there's so many ways we physically get attacked. So then protesters try to the logging truck being burned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now all those people got, they said yesterday on the news, a whole bunch of people got picked up and had been traced down, and that they were basically eco-terrorists.
Right.
And I just was appalled because property, there's a difference between killing someone, you know, running over their legs as they stand on railroad tracks with a sign,
mm-hmm.
and trying to destroy property. It's like the ships where the tea was thrown overboard.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, there's ways to protest sometimes that aren't, but they're putting it under the blanket of terrorism now.
Absolutely.
Well, now, this is what irritated me. I heard the comments made by the people in the various towns where property had been destroyed. Comments like, there was so many jobs lost after that. These environmentalists, you know, mm-hmm. are terrorists, and a lot of lies. Everything was lies.
Mm-hmm.
Jobs might have been lost, but I think those probably were jobs that the lumber companies were going to be
cutting.
And so we just get blamed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of stuff like that. But that all happened yesterday, and I was just, then I sat out on 26 when they closed down both lanes.
Mm-hmm.
I had to get into Powell's to meet my brother. And I'm just, you know, the weather's cold. Today's my birthday. I'm 60 years old today.
Happy
I'm
birthday.
I'm just very, very tired. I'm cold. I'm tired of the lies. And the lies and the lies.
I hear
lies.
You.
Yeah. And I know
the
you
The lying has to end.
But anyway, I couldn't believe my brain's not working.
You, well, no, you've brought up so many good points, and I'm really glad you did, because I think that this is, you know, I wish I had a little more lead time to really get into what went on yesterday with the subpoenas and the arrests nationwide again. A man arrested in Brooklyn facing possible life in prison is what I'm hearing.
Right, exactly.
You know,
years, like one guy.
An info shop raided in Prescott, Arizona.
And you know what they showed by mistake? And they do this a lot. They make mistakes. They're so funky.
Oh, not the FBI, never.
No, the visual stuff that they do on these TV stations.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Because they don't know what they're doing. They're just handed something and they show it. Well, it was a leftover picture. They showed the various people who were terrorists that had been picked up that had destroyed material objects in their protest.
Uh-huh.
And so they were really dangerous people. Then the last one they showed was Trey Arrow's file, and it had stamped across it finished or something like that. And they're still trying to get him out of Canada to bring him in. And I can't think of the word because I'm so cold and it's so
right.
It's not finished, which was stamped.
Concluded or something closed.
It was a red stamp, like an official FBI stamp, and meaning, you know, they were going to take care of him.
Right, right.
And
right.
I just couldn't believe it. And then it disappeared really quickly off the television screen. I don't watch TV very often, but this was too much.
Absolutely.
I wish I was more alert and more awake and warmer. My brain would be working, and I could give you real specifics of what irritated me, but basically the whole thing did.
And a couple of points. I just wanted to dovetail off of what you were saying with a couple of points being, first of all, these are subpoenas. Well, and no one actually in the mainstream news, the corporate-owned press, has talked about the subpoenas. Everyone, you know, they're focused on, I believe, the six arrests.
Uh-huh.
But in addition to that, there were subpoenas that seem like they may or may not be connected, you know, and I don't have a really firm grasp on how many of those were given out for some sort of grand jury process coming up in the spring. And, you know, again, the grand jury system has been, I believe, abused in the past, you know, really targeting activists. And so I want to make sure we finally make a distinction that these folks aren't guilty of anything, right? They've been arrested, they've been charged.
Well, do you remember what our great leader just said in Mongolia? I don't know, he visited one country where they weren't going to kill him. Mongolia, I think he was in China. He visited two countries, excuse me, China and Mongolia. And I don't think he knew what he was doing in China. I don't think they knew anything he was talking about. But he made the speech about free speech and how important it is to be able to speak up. And it was just this, I almost fell over on the floor.
Because it's the last thing.
And that's what these arrests are all
freedom
about.
Freedom is
It's really
right.
too bad hypocrisy doesn't make you explode into little bits, you know.
It's so funny. He's just standing there.
Yeah.
Mouthing off the New Yorker.
Second-twisted.
I get the New Yorker. I've been getting it for years. Because it has great covers.
Yeah.
And yes, I do read the cartoons. And it showed Bush standing there with a duster.
Yeah.
With a little apron. And Cheney in a big, huge lounge, a chair with a smoking and leaning back. And Bush was just sort of dusting him off. He's the wife and the housekeeper. Mm-hmm. And Cheney's the guy calling the shots.
Yeah, right. Pretty much.
But
well,
anyway,
listen, take care and stay warm and happy birthday.
Oh, thank you. I'm a big 6-0 today. I can't believe it. I don't feel like it at all, except going up the hill to take Kay to the goats.
Well,
it's getting a little harder.
Right.
Yes, it does.
Getting creakier.
Well, bright blessings for your new year.
I love you both. Bye.
Take care. Well, I just got this really interesting story handed to me by an intrepid reporter. Now, it's not attributed, so this could be from one of those not-so-reliable sources like Capitol Hill Blue. I don't know. But it's about Bush, and it says, last month, the congressional leaders filed into the Oval Office to meet with Bush and talk about the Patriot Act and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they said that his hardcore push to renew the more onerous provisions of the act could further alienate conservatives, you know, et cetera. And I don't give a goddamn, Bush retorted. I'm the president and the commander-in-chief. Do it my way. Mr. President, one aide in the meeting said, there's a valid case that the provisions in this law undermine the Constitution. Stop throwing the Constitution in my face, Bush screamed back. It's just a goddamned piece of paper. Now, for what that's worth, we don't know where this came from. If it's true, it certainly sounds, shall we say, plausible that he would say such a thing. It's just a goddamn piece of paper.
Hmm.
Yep, that's all it is. Just like the Magna Carta was, and
I would love
other,
to know where
you know,
that story came from.
I suspect it came from Capitol Hill Blue.
Well, we'll see if maybe our intrepid and beloved news elf can let us know that. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. And good morning to you. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, that's you.
Oh, okay. Just a comment and a observation. The forefathers of this country forged the Constitution, and it's worked just fine for all these years, and all of a sudden they want to reinvent the wheel and change so many aspects of things that have been handed down for so long. And I liken this to almost like a chess game where once you lose your queen, it doesn't matter how many pawns you have, you're done.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like they're just fattening up their queen no matter how much we gather and rally. I think a lot of it's for naught. It's going to be too late pretty quick.
Well, so what do you suggest?
Oh, I didn't say any suggestions. It was an observation.
Well, how do we continue to have constitutional rights in an era such as this? I mean, I think that the only way to go is just to aggressively use them, you know, use it or lose it, like they say about working out. You know, the same thing goes with our constitutional rights. If we don't use them, they will be gone.
Right, and I think, yeah, aggressively is probably a very appropriate word.
Assembling.
I'm going to assemble now, and you can't stop me.
Watch me peaceably assemble.
Yeah, exactly.
And practice my religion while I'm at it.
Or more like peaceably dissemble.
Well, you can go to jail for that, though.
Practicing my religion?
Yes. Yeah.
Especially our religion.
Well, you have to change it, don't you?
Well, only in certain states on certain days, I think. But, for now. You know, I do have to say, you know, there's this, the theocracy bent to this, cannot be understated. And there's, you know, so we're watching a stripping of our civil liberties, and we're watching, a very, very narrowly defined, branch of Christianity becoming, intertwined with state activity and function.
Right. There's no separation anymore.
Right. So these things coming together, I don't know, man. It don't look good, right?
Well, and then if you factor in, too, when the troops get home, that's quite the military force because they're already trained.
Yeah.
What are they going to be doing? They've got to do something. And
I suspect that the troops, when they get home from Iraq, are not going to want to do anything military for a very long time if they have a choice.
Well, but they may still be employed by the military and not have a choice.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Well, a lot of them have been forcibly conscripted to stay past their time, of course.
Right.
And so I expect those people will run as far and as fast as they can away from further military service after they've been forced to stay in longer than they planned.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks very much for your call this morning.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too.
Well, you know, what you said about the theocracy, and it ties right in with the free speech thing, I think this whole ridiculous manufactured flap about the holidays and Christmas and all that, about how we're trying to, you know, atheists are trying to wipe out Christmas, is just ludicrous. And it's just one more of the arms of the propaganda machine, which unfortunately many people are falling for, trying to persuade us why we need to have a theocracy in this country. And it's so antithetical to the purpose of the founding of America, the intents of the founders, the history of our country, where people have always just sort of, you know, well, you can be your religion and I'll be mine and we'll just get over it. And now all of a sudden, you know, we're all supposed to march in lockstep with wacko fundamentalists, and that's become the, you know, if you don't, then you're an enemy of the state. I mean, come on.
Ludicrous.
I don't think I'm overstating the case very much.
No.
That's basically what they're claiming. If you say happy holidays, then you're a terrorist. I mean, come on. What the
right,
heck?
Right. Ain't no one ever said this. And I mean, it's a classic straw man argument, you know, and it really, really points to this. See, I don't think they really have victim mentality. Well, there are some that do.
I think it's sheer propaganda and projection.
What we're watching on the nationwide level is sheer propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very effective. When someone starts to get kind of close to the nugget, you know, there is this sort of pathological response at times.
Well, yes.
To scream much louder and play the victim much more. And all those looking around go, well, we don't really know what's going on. Maybe they are. You know, no.
Yes. Well, many of us have experienced this in our personal relationships where, you know, you call your spouse or somebody on some baloney that they've done, and they start yelling about something completely unrelated because they have no real factual argument. They know you have them dead to rights, so they start screaming about something else and waving their arms, and you know, the louder they scream and shout, the more you realize that you were dead on and they can't defend themselves, you know.
Sad when that happens, but
yes,
you know, as in your personal life, so goes the nation.
Exactly.
And we gotta call it, right? We gotta call it, and we gotta move towards changing this behavior. We need a saner culture in which to live without the pitched hysteria of propaganda that we are, well, being force-fed at this point.
Sometimes I have to say I think that maybe the world would be better off if all media ceased to exist.
Hmm.
And we all had to go back to personal experience only.
Direct experience of the event.
Now, I mean, that's an interesting comment coming from somebody who's currently
talking to you on the radio.
Speaking to someone at PUL on the radio. But, I mean, I have to say, if this is what, you know, widespread media, reeks on us, maybe media is a bad idea.
Well, this is what corporate and government media reeks on us.
If you don't tell the truth, then you're in trouble.
Maybe we need to curtail who gets airwaves. Maybe they need to belong to the people. Uniformly,
or maybe,
and not corporate interests.
Maybe we could develop some kind of a vaccine against lying or something. You know, that would be nice.
Let's instead go for media democracy. I wanted to mention just a couple of highlights of that thing, the Reauthorization Act, the USA Patriot Improvement and Reauthorization Act of 2005.
Improving patriots?
So. The conference, this is actually a memo from the ACLU to all interested persons, from the National Security Policy Council, Tim Edgar. It is, again, a conference report on the Improvement Reauthorization Act. In summary, the conference report permits the records of ordinary Americans to be secretly obtained without adequate safeguards. It's covered in Sections 106 and 115 of the Reauthorization Act. While the conferees rejected a call for new FBI administrative subpoenas without any prior court review, records that are not connected to an international terrorist or spy could still be obtained using either a secret order under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act or a national security letter that can be issued by the FBI without any court or oversight. Continue to gag recipients of records demands without any prior court filing and with new criminal penalties. This would be one of those improved parts, right? As you may know, the Patriot Act put a gag order on telling someone that you've been asked to give over their records. Read this, a librarian or a banker or something like that. So this not only that was a real big bone of contention to many folks, including legislators of the conservative stripe. It's like, yeah, that's a little weird. That doesn't sound American. And so we have had a call to pull that back, right? To rescind that section of this thing, to sunset it, as it were. But in fact, this Reauthorization Act that came out of committee yesterday continues the gag and adds criminal penalties, okay? Both secret FISA orders and NSLs would continue to contain a potentially permanent gag provision that bars a recipient from telling anyone other than the recipient's lawyer that records have been obtained.
Unbelievable.
For NSLs, there is an express right to challenge the gag in court, but the burden is on the recipient to do so, and the court must accept as conclusive any government assertion that the disclosure of an NSL would harm national security, and that would just trump it.
Well, isn't that special? So all I have to do is say, off with your head, and your head goes off, huh?
Well, yeah, as a matter of fact.
How special.
A new crime of knowingly violating the gag provision of an NSL is created, with penalties of up to 1 year in prison, even if there's no intent to obstruct an investigation.
This is just really, 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 I'm sorry, I just keep seeing, the SS and Hitler before my eyes.
Allows sneak and peek searches under a broad standard. New time limits would allow such searches to continue to remain secret for weeks, months, or even years. Allow secret eavesdropping and secret search orders that do not name a target or location with an enhanced court oversight. They reform the Patriot Act's definition of domestic terrorism to provide that assets may not be forfeited except where the organization or individual is involved in a serious federal crime.
You know what I want to know? Isn't this all of this basically saying, in a nutshell?
I wanted to explain what that one was. Because that may not have, this is all kind of like, what? What was that? We could do what? So that, while the current overbroad definition of domestic terrorism remains in place, which covers any unlawful activity that's dangerous to human life and could cover the civil disobedience activities of some protest organizations. The civil forfeiture statute is amended to provide that a narrower list of federal crimes would be used for forfeiture purposes. So that's one of the things that folks are saying, see, we're protecting you.
Right. We're protecting your stuff, but not you.
Right. We've made it better. Exactly mm-hmm. the point.
Your
exactly
stuff will remain
point.
Behind, but you'll be in prison for the rest of your life. How handy.
But your stuff has more rights now.
Well, you know, what I wanted to say is, isn't this all basically saying, you know, what I want to know is if, you know, the FBI is after, you know, Mumar, who's like some horrible terrorist, why do they need all these extraordinary provisions? Why don't the normal things that they have already at their disposal before the Patriot Act suffice? Isn't it like saying we're totally incompetent, and so we're using the, you know, 9/11 as an excuse to basically let us do whatever we want so that we can ride roughshod all over your rights, because although we have plenty of tools already, we don't feel like using them, or we're too lazy and incompetent to get the bad guys using those? I mean, isn't that basically what this is all kind of saying?
Well, you could phrase it that way. I think you could phrase it that way. 503-231-8187, the number to call. Good morning to you. You're on the air.
Well, good morning. How are my wickedness this morning?
Oh, you know, not so bad.
We're a little cold, but otherwise good.
Okay, well, this is LJ.
Hello, LJ.
Good morning.
Okay, number one, I'm sitting in a nice, warm, little cozy house drinking a drinking a cup of joe. I am now burning bio.
Good okay. for you.
And I'm going to, I'll tell you what, you guys, it's absolutely miraculous.
How are you doing this exactly?
And we have a furnace, a quote, oil furnace.
Uh-huh.
And the oil furnace downstairs takes bio without any conversions at all.
Oh, I wow. see. So you're using biodiesel right. as fuel oil.
Right.
I gotcha.
And I'm going to tell you what, you guys, it's like a miracle. It burns at least 25 degrees hotter. I'm serious.
Really?
Yeah, I'm serious. I could feel the difference in the amount of heat I'm coming out of the vent.
That's very interesting. Yeah, I've noticed that my gas furnace, the air that comes out isn't all that hot.
No,
really.
It's not. Well, gas is lousy, you guys. No offense.
Well, yeah, I'm aware.
Yeah.
That's also what I have.
And the upshot is that my house smells like McDonald's French fries.
Ew. Ew. That's kind of disgusting.
And my neighbors are delighted.
Oh, that's so funny.
We don't need to go to McDonald's anymore. We can just sniff your house.
Yes. Come on over, take a sniff.
Oh, my God. That is so funny, LJ.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Listen. This is a little box that they've given us to work in.
Uh-huh.
Okay? But what they can't stop us from doing is forming community.
Right.
What they can't stop us from doing is talking to each other. All right?
Right.
Okay. I get around on a bicycle or I walk. Okay?
Uh-huh.
I don't want to be stuck in a glass and steel coffin because that isolates me from my community. Unacceptable.
Uh-huh.
Okay? My personal goal when I'm out and about is to talk to at least 10 to 15 people every day.
Uh-huh.
All right, that's my personal goal. My message is that we have to build a strong local economy.
Okay? Yes.
And being that this is shopping season, and you really don't need another $59 TV from Walmart, what you should really do is spend your money with local merchants who buy local products, and keep the money in the loop, all right? Because I'm a firm believer in the Republic of Cascadia.
Absolutely.
All right? I really think that that we ought to look at the possibility of seceding from the Union.
I think it's a very complicated procedure, but it's certainly a nice thought.
Well, I chat it up all of the time, and I really give a lot of people food for thought.
Yeah.
All I tell them is, think about it. You know, think on it. Run it around in your melon and like, see what you think. All right. In the summertime, when I'm out and about, I talk to at least 20 to 25 people every day.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And you would be surprised what a simple good morning, how are you, does to somebody. It, like, wakes them up. It, like, brings a smile to their face. And there's actually somebody out there who cares how I am.
I think that in a lot of ways you're serving a role in the community, sort of like many years ago. I lived in Southern California, and there used to be a gentleman down in Laguna Beach, mm-hmm. California, who was world famous. His name was Eiler Larson. He's passed on now, and he mm-hmm. was called the Greeter. Mm-hmm. And he used to stand out on a street corner in Laguna Beach all day, every day, and smile and wave at people.
That's right.
And he was world famous.
That's right. I remember him. Here's my inspiration. All right. So what we really need to do as a community is connect with each other.
You know, I couldn't argue with that at all. I think that's absolutely essential.
Okay.
Absolutely essential. Thank you so much for your call
Thank
this morning.
Thank you very, very much. Happy winter solstice.
Same to you.
Bye-bye.
Stay warm.
And we do have with us by phone Lisa Graves, the Senior Counsel for Legislative Strategy of the ACLU. Good morning, Lisa.
Hello? Lisa, are you there? We'll be
getting Lisa momentarily. Again, looking at the Patriot Act, looking at civil liberties.
That's not the line she's on.
We'll be getting Lisa back momentarily. Let's just go and do that back announcing thing, huh? I'm Ronnie.
I'm Melody. This is Positively Revolting Talk Radio. It's about
you 8, gotta know it.
8:20, so almost 8:28. We're going to be here till 9, but you don't want to leave then because all kinds of exciting things are going to happen after that.
I had a personal Marlena sighting.
A personal Marlena sighting?
I saw her.
Ooh.
So Marlena is in the house. She'll be bringing you the electronic salon at 9 a.m. And again, you'll want to stay tuned to KABU.
I mean, you don't really don't want to go outside if you don't have to. It's cold and windy and nasty out there. Stay warm and listen to KABU.
So we were talking a little bit ago about these subpoenas and that sort of thing. And I just want to go over briefly the general sort of heads up when police or, say, the FBI or, say, what have you.
Don't open the door without
they,
a warrant.
Should they come and say, we have a subpoena for you, or we need to talk to you now, or something like that? Remember, you don't have to speak to police or FBI agents. It is my understanding that it is always a good idea to ask for a lawyer pretty much immediately.
Do not ever let them in your home without a warrant. If you do choose to speak to them, exit your home, close the door behind you.
If they say they have a warrant, demand to see it. Tell mm-hmm. them to slide it under the door or through the mail slot. You need to make sure the information on the warrant's correct. And again, always ask to speak to a lawyer. It's not really a good idea, generally speaking, to just, well, off the cuff, talk to law enforcement officers when they have approached you and you're unsettled. That's just generally not a good idea.
And if you open the door and stand in the door open and talk to them, they can press their way into the home and claim that because you opened the door that's
was an invitation.
Invitation to entry.
So, you know, there are. It's really time to brush up on your basic civil rights. And as Melody said earlier, it's time to aggressively use civil rights.
Yes. Use them or lose them.
So, with that in mind, now I do believe we have Lisa back on the line. That was just a little piece of information I really want to make sure got out there in light of yesterday's arrests. But good morning, Lisa.
Good morning. Thanks for having us on.
Oh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for joining us. I'm sure you are extremely busy this morning given yesterday's actions of the Reauthorization Act passing through the committee. But thank you, Lisa Graves, Senior Counsel for Legislative Strategy from the ACLU, for joining us. And welcome to KABU.
Thanks for having us on. We are very concerned about the Patriot Act, and I really appreciated the pre-introduction of urging people to brush up on their rights.
Yes.
That's a definite public service.
Yeah, well, you know, it seems now is a very important time to remember what they are, learn what they are, and exercise them. I'll just sort of bring you up to date of what we've been talking about for the last hour, is the waning civil rights that we have.
Civil liberties.
I'm sorry, civil liberties that we have.
Civil rights too, but
I'm sorry, I'm trying not to cough while talking all at the same time. My brain just went. the waning civil liberties that we have, and especially in light of the Patriot Act not sunsetting and, in fact, actually gaining some new measures, some new criminal penalties, and penalties for which the death penalty can be sought. Can you just briefly give your perspective of what happened yesterday and what its significance is?
Well, yesterday in Washington, D.C., a few members of Congress came together to say that they had reached a, quote, compromise, which was really a concession to the administration to basically move forward with a bill to reauthorize the Patriot Act, make almost all of it permanent, and not fix the most fundamental failure in that law, which is that right now, under the Patriot Act, the FBI can gather the financial records, internet transactions, medical records, any tangible thing about any American citizen without any connection between them and a suspected terrorist. And so next week, Congress is poised to vote on this bill that doesn't fix this most fundamental flaw, and we're certainly hoping that members of Congress, senators, will come together to oppose this bill, to block it, to filibuster it, because Americans' privacy needs to be protected.
Absolutely. In fact, it's my understanding that this particular Reauthorization Act actually adds penalties for people who may pass on that records were being searched, people that break the gag order. Can you comment on that at all?
Sure, sure. You know, one of the ways that this bill is really a bunch of smoke and mirrors is they would give the businesses who receive these demands for financial records or internet transactions, they would give them a right to challenge the automatic gag that prevents them from telling their customers ever about the receipt of these demands for their records. 1 year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, they can never tell anyone. They can't tell the press. They can't tell their customers. So this bill would give them a, quote, right to challenge the gag. But then if the government came to court and said that they needed to have the gag for national security or diplomatic relations or an ongoing investigation in the criminal area, the court would be required to treat that assertion as conclusive. And what that means in lay speak, in ordinary speak, is you just can't win. There's no way to win the challenge of these gags. And so basically, the customers, the American people, will never know that their records have been turned over, and the businesses, for all intents and purposes, are banned forever from telling anyone about it.
Well, and what legitimate investigative purpose, you know, tracking down some you know, criminal, could this possibly serve? I just don't see how it could.
Well, we certainly think, and we're joined by people on both the right and the left in this, that we think that our federal law enforcement, our precious anti-terrorism resources, ought to be focused on the bad guys, meaning people that they suspect
who are
of
actually
being a terrorist,
yes.
people who they have some reason to believe are connected to Al-Qaeda, not ordinary people who've done nothing wrong, who are minding their own business, who have no connection to a suspected terrorist. We have seen news reports from investigative reporting that the FBI has issued tens of thousands of national security letters. And each of these letters can sweep in tens, you know, hundreds, tens, thousands of people. And so right now, with these, the extensive use of these powers, innocent people's records are being gathered by the FBI. The Justice Department admitted just last week that innocent people's records are gathered. Their justification is that that they feel like they have to follow every tip. Well, you know, it's one thing to follow every tip, and it's another thing to use that as the tip of the iceberg, basically, to gather insurance records, financial records, internet records on anyone. It could be someone who a spiteful spouse or neighbor has a grudge against. You know, it doesn't have to be someone who has any connection at all to a suspected terrorist, and we think that just goes too far.
Well, or, of course, it could be someone whose political views the powers that be don't like, which is probably a lot more likely.
Well, there's that. You know, the American Civil Liberties Union has been involved in a Freedom of Information Act suit to gather information about how these joint terrorism task forces are being used, which have caused a great deal of controversy out west and across the country. And through that FOIA request, that Freedom of Information request, we've learned that thousands of papers have been collected about the ACLU. And all we're doing, we're certainly, we can't imagine that we would be of any interest to these task forces. All the ACLU has been doing has been trying to make sure that people understand what their rights are and that our American Constitution is defended and protected.
Well, that makes you a terrorist right there by some of their definitions. You know, I mean, it's just, this is just ludicrous to me that they actually expect that people believe that there could be a legitimate reason for concealing forever the fact that they subpoenaed your ISP records or your library records or even your medical records. And I really don't understand, if you were pursuing some legitimate terror target, why would you know, there be a need to put a gag on the people you secured the records from?
Well, if the request were focused, like it was before the Patriot Act was passed, on a target of an investigation, if you wanted to get, for instance, Muhammad Atta's internet records or something, because you knew he was connected to Al-Qaeda, you know, that's one thing. Then you might want to have that ISP not tip him off. But if an ISP is receiving a broader request for any computer transactions on a computer at an internet cafe, gathering, you know, records of anyone who used that computer, keeping those records forever, disseminating them across the federal government, you know, without any connection between those records and a suspected terrorist, you know, that's a whole other kettle of fish.
Well, and how would they have any way of knowing who used the computer at the internet cafe or the library? I just don't understand how you could determine that.
Well, exactly, and that's why the records are so vulnerable, because what the Patriot Act did in basically the dark of night was say that the government no longer had to have a connection between the records they want and a suspected terrorist. Basically, under the Patriot Act, the FBI was given not just a blank check, but basically a blank checkbook to determine for itself, without any court approval, whatever it deemed relevant. And the FBI has suggested, along with the Department of Justice, that they would never, ever seek anything that was irrelevant.
Of course not. Never.
To our history, the FBI surveillance of Martin Luther King and thousands of other civil rights workers and activists in the 60s and 70s.
And of course, we also...
90s and teens, and aughts, rather.
Right. The aughts, yes.
Yeah.
Stability is projecting into the future. But you know, and of course, we've seen that it doesn't really work when the FBI polices themselves very well.
No. Well, and I think that's really the genius of our Constitution, is that, you know, whatever the flaws in the original Constitution in terms of slavery and women's rights, one of the things the Founding Fathers got right was that power will inherently be abused if it isn't kept in check. It's just the nature of power. And it doesn't matter whether it's the FBI, whether it's the president, whether it's Congress. There have to be checks and balances on these powers.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons why we've been able to have such a broad right-left coalition, because doesn't matter which political party is in power, no political party, no president, no FBI, even with a bunch of good agents and some bad apples, you know, should have the unilateral power to gather records on anyone they deem relevant in any investigation that they authorize without any court oversight and without any limitation consistent with our Fourth Amendment, that there be some cause, some specific individualized suspicion about that person or their records that make it pertinent, that make it necessary to gather those records and invade their privacy.
Well, before you joined us, we were talking about a press release that I saw yesterday about an environmental group in Colorado that the FBI has been keeping secret tabs on, claiming that they're terrorists, even though they're just, you know, the usual environmental group having rallies, calling for people to do civil disobedience, like blocking streets. And the FBI agent that was quoted in the story basically said that he felt that the keeping tabs on them was legitimate because, after all, they were infringing on people's rights, and so technically they fell under they could fall under the definition of terrorism because they were infringing on other people's rights and by blocking the street. I think that's just really a frightening stretch.
It's extraordinary, and under the Patriot Act right now, under the definition of domestic terrorism that some of these partisans put in the law back in 2001, any entity that engages in any activity that, for the purpose of affecting a government policy, that is a violation of even state misdemeanor laws, that they believe, you know, threatens would threaten life, such as laying down in traffic to, you know, block traffic as part of a protest to get attention for an issue, that organization can be considered a domestic terrorism organization, and their assets can be seized, and all these other surveillance powers can be triggered.
Now, see, that's just outrageous as far as I'm concerned.
It is, and actually what's disturbing as well, beyond the fact of the reach of these powers, the sanctions, the surveillance, those sorts of things, is the fact that the administration, in its release about who it's watching, seems to be watching, you know, only people on the progressive side, or primarily people on the progressive side, and underplaying the other side, the right side, the hate groups, the, you know, supremacist organizations.
People who blow up abortion clinics and shoot abortion doctors, for example?
Or the federal Aramura building in Oklahoma City.
Yes.
And there was a recent report just last week of an investigation, a terrorism investigation that was basically bungled by the administration. I think there was a New York Times article about it. And it's the worry is that, you know, there's that these powers are so extraordinary that they certainly can be focused on certain groups of people to the exclusion of other groups who may be equally or more dangerous to the American people.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about that bipartisan opposition to the continuation of the Patriot Act. There is a threat of filibuster at this point, and we also have, as you said, bipartisan support in that filibuster, including, you know, well, obviously several Republicans, Larry Craig of Idaho, John Sununu of New Hampshire. John Sununu
Hampshire. Even a stop clock is right twice a day.
You know, I'm just, it's really an interesting time that we're living in when people are, you know, when people who I've long known as not really a good friend of generally the causes I'm interested in supporting, suddenly going, wait a minute, no, this is too far.
Well, that's one of the things that's been so interesting and inspiring about kind of fighting this struggle has been that people on the right and the left, people who have, you know, different social issue views than each other, have come together to say that these powers just go too far. And in Washington, which is just marked by so much partisanship and so much just division, the notion that some of these members on both sides would come together and say, we have common ground, and the common ground is our Constitution, it's our fundamental Fourth Amendment rights, and we're going to stand up to the political parties, we're going to stand up to the administration, and stand up for the American people, you know, few people and policies could unite these politicians in this way, but the Patriot Act really goes so far in intruding on the fundamental rights of ordinary Americans that we've been able to knit together a coalition that includes these really diverse politicians and individuals.
Well, and I hope they're successful, because I just think that, you know, the implications of the Patriot Act are so little understood and known by the public, and yet they're so far-reaching. I just fear, you know, another 4 years, and, of course, down the road 4 more years, of course, there'll be more excuses to extend it even further.
I was going to say many of these aren't – this is not – the Reauthorization Act is not necessarily scheduled to sunset. Is that –
That's right. Most of the powers in the original Patriot Act are permanent.
Right. So it wouldn't be like another 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Only some of them are temporary, and the few that are temporary, most of those are being made permanent by this bill that's going to go to Congress next week. And a few powers would be extended for 4 years, but that's 4 more years during which people's privacy rights can be, you know, violated. And what's really shocking to me, actually, was it was a bit of a surprise, not that I hadn't heard it before in Washington, was hearing both the administration and some partisans suggest that you don't have a right to privacy in documents held by a business about you. They have taken the position that basically if a business has information about you, whether it's your medical records or your financial records, that you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy, that just because a business has that information about you, the government can have that information about you.
That's just outrageous.
It's really outrageous. One member actually came to the meeting of the senators and members who were talking about the Patriot Act, who were supposed to be negotiating, and he said, it's almost a literal quote, he said, if you don't want to know how much money you have, then don't go to a bank. It was shocking.
Right. The only way to guarantee your privacy is to stash cash under your mattress.
Yes, it was really,
it's sounding
rather
more
outrageous.
Tempting all the time.
Yeah, and the note, and it's just, it's contrary to our statutes. Federal statutes have been written to protect people's health privacy, medical privacy. The statute has been written to protect people's financial privacy.
Right.
And yet this administration and some of its allies have come before Congress publicly and privately and suggested that the American people don't have any right to privacy in any of their transactions that are captured by any of the businesses or even their employers that they work with. Just because someone else knows something about you, that means that you no longer have a right to prevent the government from having that information about you. That is a shocking turn of events.
That really is. And just to make the assertion and to make it publicly and expect that there it is, just going to float, I think is really about the scariest commentary on where the American public is and where we are as a society right now. Like, I can't imagine these kinds of sweeping changes in, say, most European countries sort of going on unnoticed by the majority of the populace.
Or uncared about in many cases.
So how do we, what's our next step? We have a vote coming up before Congress next week, we think. What's the next step of people who want to defend civil liberties?
Well, I think, first of all, people need to be talking with each other and you're doing a tremendous public service in letting people know that their privacy really is at risk. And the first thing they could do in the next couple of days is call the local offices of their members of Congress.
Yes.
And tell them that they want them to block this bill, that they want them to stand up for our privacy, and that they know that America can and must be both safe and free. We want these precious anti-terrorism resources focused on the bad guys and not on the rest of us. And this is a common sense fix to require that there be some connection, any connection, between the records they want and a suspected terrorist before they gather basically the transactions of our daily life, our financial records, medical records, library records, internet transactions, what have you, that there ought to be at least some connection. You know, one would argue that maybe you should have more, but at a minimum, they should have some connection.
Right.
And that's just what we expect from our members of Congress, and basically to tell them that they're going to watch that vote. That vote will likely happen next week in both houses of Congress. Once that vote happens, I think we have a long road ahead of us in the coming year and the coming years to really have people stand up for their privacy, because unfortunately some of the partisans who have a great deal of power right now don't believe that people have a fundamental right to privacy, whether it's rights for reproductive choice, which is a separate issue, or rights under the Fourth Amendment to the privacy of their papers and their records. However you might define the right to privacy, it's clearly under assault by this administration, and it's unfortunate because the right to privacy, the right to not be gathered into a government database, the right to not have your papers searched, to have that autonomy, to not have this country become some sort of Orwellian 1984 country. You know, these things, this is a real turning point. This year, next year, the coming few years will determine our future. And it's a big crisis. We have related issues involving the so-called employer verification provisions that are going to be in these immigration bills debated next year, where the government wants to say that you have to call the federal government to get permission to work. It's not just about immigrants. Every single person who takes a new job would have to get federal permission to work under these proposals. These employer verification proposals, they sound innocuous. But what they mean at the end of the day is that every person hired in this country would have to have the federal government give them permission to work. And if they deny you permission to work, you can't have a job, and you have to go fight faceless, nameless bureaucrats in Washington to try to prove that you're a citizen, to prove that you are who you say you are. So we have some big fights coming up next week on Patriot Act, next year on some of these tremendous privacy intrusive provisions, and we're going to need the help of every American to wake up and say, you know, I expect my privacy to be protected. That's one of the reasons why this country is so great.
Well, and our rights to employment, in the least in Oregon, are already being threatened, for some subgroups of citizens here are basically being denied the right to employment, even on the state level already. So this is just very, very chilling. I mean, I think that their end goal is to have a nation of basically a dispossessed class who has no rights to participate in economic or political life, and then a class of the possessed, so to speak, who have everything. And that's completely antithetical to the intention of the Constitution. I mean, I know there's been a lot of joking about, oh, the Fourth Amendment, didn't they repeal that? But really, I mean, the Fourth Amendment would seem to preclude all those things, and yet we're just proceeding apace like it doesn't exist.
Right. I think that, you know, technology has changed so much. There are some proponents on the right wing who say, you know, well, it would just be like swiping a credit card to get to pay for a bill in order to swipe a credit card to get permission to work. Well, that's only true if the credit card holder is the federal government.
Right.
The federal government, right, who, you know, in some instances when people have been declared dead by the Social Security Administration,
yes,
that it's been months to get themselves undeclared dead. Can you imagine the consequences,
mm-hmm,
for the American people, for the American workforce?
Yes.
If you can't get a job, you can't pay your mortgage, you can't have your health insurance, you can't provide for your family. Meanwhile, you're fighting someone in Washington to try to prove you are who you say you are. And this applies to citizens and immigrants. It's not just a targeted program which would have its own sort of issues. This would create a system in which every single person in America who's hired by an employer has to get federal permission to work. So don't believe it when they call it employer verification. It's 1-800 Big Brother.
Right, right. I was going to say this
really
brings visions of Terry Gilliam's Brazil into my head, and it's not a good movie to. It's a great movie. It's not a good movie to try to live in. I don't want to go there.
Right.
So, Melody, you have some promo announcements coming up.
I do indeed. I want
to
let you know that it's just 7 minutes left in our show. But you don't want to go away, because at 9 we'll be hearing Marlena's Electronic Salon, and she'll have local naturopath Dr. Stephen Bailey. He'll discuss cold and flu symptoms and how to tell the difference between them. Later, Marlena will speak with Dr. Justin Frank, author of Bush on the Couch. He'll have an update on George W. Bush from a psychiatric perspective. We'll also hear more from Michael Mead on the importance of myth in our lives. And at 11... on Democracy Now!, New Orleans evacuees testify on the role of race and class in the government's response to Katrina. And how many are still missing after Katrina? Does anyone know? And I would like to add, does anyone care in the government anyway?
Well, yeah, it's a question that really, really needs to be answered. Well, again, our time is fleeting. And I'm losing my voice. So I really wanted to touch again on sort of the hopeful, what we can do together. We can contact members of Congress. And again, next week is the date we're looking at for Congress to vote on the Reauthorization Act. Where can people get more information about this sort of thing, Lisa?
Well, the ACLU has a lot of quick and easy-to-understand descriptions about the Patriot Act and what it means to you and your privacy, and that's on our website at www.aclu.org. So please go there, click on Safe and Free, and that will get you more information. There's also an opportunity to use the website to help contact your member of Congress. We certainly hope, and I think that the double tragedies of Katrina certainly indicate that the illusion of security is something to worry about. And really, the Patriot Act creates an illusion of security, but doesn't necessarily make us safer if the government is making the haystack that they're trying to find needles in bigger by using these powers to obtain records on innocent Americans who have done nothing wrong. And so we certainly hope that your callers will contact their members of Congress, tell them to block this bill, to vote against it, and to preserve and stand up for our privacy in this country, the legacy of privacy and liberty that our founding fathers left to us.
You know, I wanted to ask you before we run out of time, if you have any comment on the tragic shooting of the gentleman in Miami the other day, Mr. Alpizar.
Well, I haven't had a chance to look at that case closely, although I was certainly shocked to see what I saw in the news, and it seemed to echo what happened in London a couple months ago.
Yes.
But I haven't had a chance to see, you know, what the facts were, and so I don't want to comment on it. I've just been so immersed in Patriot and immigration that I haven't had a chance to actually read the newspaper. So I'm looking forward to getting caught up and seeing, you know, what happened in that case.
Yeah, well, I absolutely understand that. I was just dumbfounded yesterday as I sat down for about 6 hours to try to catch up on news of the last 3 days. It's things are going at quite a pace right now.
So, Lisa, again, thank you for taking your time this morning to join us here on KBOO. And we thank you for your work at the ACLU.
Yes, indeed.
Thank
keep
you
on
so
fighting
much.
The good fight.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. And I'm sure we'll be talking with you or other folks from the ACLU soon. And it's the voice of the goddess in my head.
She speaks. Let's take that caller
very
quickly.
Let's do that. Good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. I just want to quickly say that this is a war against the American people.
Yes, it is.
And the Patriot Act is just another weapon in these, I don't know what to call them, people's arsenal.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for your call.
It's so true. I mean, you know, basically all of our constitutional protections are being undermined. And, you know, I don't know if it's really true that Bush said that, you know, stop throwing the Constitution in my face. It's just a goddamn piece of paper. But it certainly seems plausible enough considering the actions of his administration. And, you know,
whether he, I mean, you know, okay, so I admit Capitol Hill blues, not maybe such the stellar and stalwart. And yet
it's,
you know,
hard not to believe that he
I have to say his actions are certainly
yes,
concurrent with that
yes,
sentiment.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
And that's, I guess, to me, the most important point. It's how he's acting. And if, you know, if his actions would support that statement, mm-hmm. then we got some trouble. Houston,
yes,
we got a problem.
Yes, we do.
All right. So I want to remind folks again about your rights. Please take some time to familiarize yourself with your rights.
Before it's too late and they go away.
You know, just remember, you don't have to speak to police or FBI agents. It is without a warrant. It is important to ask for a lawyer. It is important to demand a lawyer before you talk to anyone.
Yes.
It's important to understand the FBI and the police cannot enter your home without a warrant.
Or your car, by the way. Our engineer asked earlier about, you know, your rights when you're traveling in your car. And I'd encourage everyone to look on the Internet for a video called Busted, which was made by the ACLU. It's a short video that's very informative about how to handle a traffic stop properly.
And there's also, yeah, it's just important. Brush up on your rights. Portland Cop Watch has a great resource card of your rights in the police, mm-hmm. like the bullet point format reference card. Handy. Pick one of those
what
up.
What to do, what not to do.
Also, remember the WTO rally tomorrow, Southwest First and Salmon. That's at noon. I hear a rumor we have a call. Let's see if we can squeeze you in for 1 minute. Good morning.
Good morning. Great show this morning.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Left wing, beware. The right wing is alive and well and in power.
It's true. You have just a couple of seconds. Is there anything else you want to add? Nope.
Oh, that was quick.
That was short and sweet and to the point. So, again,
but
no,
you know,
to
the
WTO.
The power too.
We do have the power. We have the power of community, as LJ pointed out earlier. Mm-hmm. The power is in community. Get together, people. Educate each other. And take action together. Remember to practice solidarity like your life depends on it, because in fact it does. Like a zombie risen from the dead, the WTO is back. Say no to the WTO. Say yes to the right to organize. That's tomorrow. Again, First and Salmon at noon tomorrow. Learn how to resist the WTO in every form at the PSU Koinonia Center. There's a teach-in. That's 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. December 17th. So that's a week from tomorrow, a teach-in, 10 to 4 at the Koinonia House at PSU. Get active. Stay active. Be together.
Be positively revolting.
And it's 9 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing. Featuring 100% natural fiber clothing for women and men, real clothing for real people, proud to sponsor the important voice of KBOO. Gazelle is located at Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-288-3422. Coming up next, Marlena's Electronic Salon.
can't stay.
But baby, it's cold outside.
I've got to go away.
But baby, it's cold outside.
This evening has been
hoping that you drop in.
So very nice.
I'll hold your hands, they're just like
my
ice.
Mother will start to worry.
Beautiful, what's your
and
hurry?
Father will be pacing the floor.
Listen to the fireplace
so
roar.
So really, I'd better scurry.
Beautiful, please don't
well,
hurry.
Well, maybe just a half a drink
put
more.
Put some records on while I pour.
The neighbors might think.
But baby, it's bad out there.
Say, what's in this drink?
No cabs to be had out there.
I wish I knew how.
Your eyes are like starlight
to break
now.
The spell.
I'll take your hat. Your hair looks swell.
I ought to say no, no,
mind
no,
if
sir.
I move in closer?
At least I'm gonna say that I tried.
What's the sense of hurting my pride?
I really can't stay.
Oh, baby, don't hold out, baby.
Ah, but it's cold outside. I simply must go.
But baby, it's cold outside.
The answer is no.
But baby, it's cold outside.
The welcome has been.
How lucky that you
so
dropped in.
So nice and warm.
Look out that window at that star.
My sister will be suspicious.
Gosh, your lips look delicious.
My brother will be there at the door.
Waves upon the tropical shore.
My maiden aunt's mind is
gosh,
vicious.
Gosh, your lips are delicious.
Well, maybe just a cigarette more.
Never such a blizzard before.
I've got to get home.
But baby, you'd freeze out there.
Say, lend me a comb.
It's up to your knees out there.
You've really been grand.
I thrill when you touch
but
my hand.
Don't you see?
How can you do this thing to
there's
me?
There's bound to be talk tomorrow.
Think of my lifelong sorrow.
At least there will be plenty implied.
If you caught pneumonia and
I really can't stay.
Get over that old doubt.
Ah, but it's cold outside.
Where could you be going when the wind is blowing and it's cold outside?
Baby, it's cold outside.
Ooh, baby, it is cold outside, and you're warmed up by your community station and have that glowing feeling inside because you made it possible to have a community radio station, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 on the FM band, non-corporate, community-owned radio. I'm Marlena Smith. This is the Electronic Salon, and you just heard Baby, It's Cold Outside, great old standard in the jazz world. That was Ella Fitzgerald doing the vocals with Louis Jordan and his Timpani Five, recorded April 28th, 1949, in New York City. Love those old ones. Had Maureen Whiting, I think, and Johnny Mercer, but couldn't find the CD. That's the other standard version of that, so we'll look around for that. Let's see. Interesting day today. Interesting news. I have Dr. Stephen Bailey with us for the first hour. We're going to talk about health-related matters. He's a naturopathic physician, and I just want to put out a quick disclaimer. This is an information show. If you have health-related issues, you need to seek your primary medical provider for a legitimate discussion and health evaluation. This is a call-in segment and an information segment. We'll be talking about the immune system, separating a cold from a flu, and that sort of thing. Then at 10 o'clock, I have Dr. Justin Frank. He's a psychiatrist from Washington, D.C. You heard him last year on this show. He wrote a book called Bush on the Couch. So we're going to do an update on the mental health of President Bush. And then after that, depending on the amount of time we have, we're going to continue with our myth and storytelling from Michael Mead. We'll be playing some commentary from Michael in a CD titled Initiation and the Soul, the Sacred and the Profane. Okay, a couple of announcements before we go to Stephen. Heating up the fight, our right to organize unions, the fight against the WTO and the corporate trade agenda. International Human Rights Day is December 10. So at noon, there'll be a gathering at First and Salmon with a related international fair trade teach-in at the Coin Center at PSU on December 17th from 10 to 4. And this is what the game is all about. Corporate control of the world and the end of democracy, and all those people who say they hate government or they want less government, most of whom don't really know that what that really means is an end of government and control by corporations. So it's democracy or corporations. And that's what unions are about. You work in a corporate center. If you don't have a union, then there's arbitrary control. And the union simply means that the workers have an opportunity to have some democracy. So that's important. Also want to let you know there's a Winter Solstice concert featuring Todd Samuelson and I think it's Linda Tomasi, post-industrial folk music at 8 p.m. Saturday, December 17th at the Red and Black Cafe at Southeast 22 and Division. Also want to let you know Cinema 21 is going to be featuring Sarah Silverman, a film she made, a very interesting female comic titled Jesus is Magic. I've seen some excerpts. This promises to be an interesting take on comedy. This is one of the foremost up-and-coming young female comics. I like her stuff. And then I found a really interesting blurb in a health-related publication that comes to my house unsolicited called the healthcareerweb.com. And you know there's a nursing shortage all over the country, so now there's a huge ad from the U.S. Navy Nurse Corps. And I would caution anyone who thinks about that as a good option to consider stop-loss and the continuing conflict in the Middle East, and that's where you would go. Also, because we have a full moon coming up next Thursday, December 15th, I thought I'd read from the Mountain Astrologer just to update all you astrology freaks and to remind you that Mr. Bush is continuing to get hit by lots and lots of powerful aspects right now, including some squaring behavior between Saturn and Jupiter, which do not bode well. These are some significant challenges for him. So keep that in mind as we read, and he certainly is being challenged. Reading from the Mountain Astrologer, Pluto, Kali, Pele, Osiris, and Anna. Every culture has its image of transformation, of death and rebirth. This full moon peaks just as the sun makes its yearly rendezvous with Pluto. We're poised on yet another evolutionary edge, ready to see deeper truth and further horizons. Shift happens when Pluto's in the spotlight. Defenses are breached, secrets are revealed, shadows are illuminated. Whatever has been shoved into the unconscious starts to surface. Pretext, rationalization, and other forms of denial become harder to maintain. And think about Washington, D.C. with that one. With Pluto closely conjuncting the sun and opposite moon, passions are going to run high as inconsistencies and falsehoods continue to be challenged. It's time for truth or consequences. Jupiter in Scorpio is within a day of squaring Saturn. With the jovial sky god aspecting the Reaper, it's time to revise and restructure. Jupiter tells us that everything is possible. Saturn reminds us that everything has a price. Both of these planets deal with power on a symbolic level. Jupiter, the power of belief. Saturn, the power of tenacity. This waxing square traces back to the last conjunction in May of 2000, which coincided with major economic and political shifts. In mythology, Jupiter overthrows Saturn. Their conjunction, which occurs every 20 years, still corresponds to significant changes in leadership and social mores. A square marks a turning point in a testing of our original intention. On a personal level, this square shows us that the assumptions that are holding us back, as well as the parameters we need to accept, are being highlighted. Mars, goes retrograde, which was retrograde on October 1st, is the degree sensitized by the last Jupiter-Saturn conjunction. Mars, the red planet, energizes and transforms relationships to money, security, and the material world, as Mars opposes Jupiter and squares Saturn through the rest of this year. Neptune at 15 degrees Aquarius forms a fixed cross with Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn and offers a way out. By using compassion, equality, and collaboration rather than competition, inequity, and oppression. Venus, Taurus, ruling planet, plays a prominent role at this full moon and in the coming weeks. The goddess of love and beauty enters Aquarius at the peak of this full moon and is less than 1 degree from Chiron, the wounded healer, in Aquarius. This conjunction helps bridge differences and heal old rifts. On December 24, Venus goes retrograde, signaling a reappraisal of relationships and values. Of all the planets, Venus is retrograde the least number of days. She turns retrograde once every year and a half for 42 days, giving us time to look below the surface appearance and uncover our real desire. What have we under or overvalued? What's worth our time and energy? What needs to be resolved before we can proceed? Friendships and partnerships and communities may look very different by February 3rd when Venus goes direct. The Sabian symbols for this full moon indicate opportunities for a big breakthrough if we trust instincts and act with integrity. For the sun at 24 Sag on the day of the full moon, a bluebird perched on the gates of a cottage, symbolically the reward which meets every effort at integration into a social environment for those who remain true to their own selves. The opposing moon at 24 degrees Gemini, children skating over a frozen village pond, the use of inhibiting circumstances for the development of character and a transcendent approach to the environment. Now, interestingly, in a parenthetical note, Mr. Bush is being confronted on his north and south node, which is his dharma on the north side and his karma on the south side. So he's being confronted to deal with past mistakes and what he's going to do about that in the present future. This is a huge impact on Mr. Bush, which is one of the reasons we're going to be talking to Justin Frank in an hour to look at the inner mind of Mr. Bush. Back to the text. New truths come to light around this full moon, as they always do, showing us where we've been operating on blind faith or limited information. In whatever place you find the truth and with whatever name it may be labeled, take it. Time to become authentic. To become liberated from sectarian, conventional, and authoritarian narrowness is to regard every inspired book as a Bible. By remaining open to truth from different sources and fitting that together like a mosaic, we eventually get some sort of pattern. That from the Mountain Astrologer. And because it is the second Friday, Dr. Bailey is with us this morning. So, Stephen, hello.
Good morning, Marlena.
Oh, look, you weren't there.
I'm not there.
You weren't there. Let's see if you're there. Let's see if you're here.
Good morning.
There you are.
There we go.
See, I like to play with these red lights. It gives me a lot of entertainment.
And good morning to everybody out there in KBOO land, which are those people that are hearing us now. So you were going to start with a little bit of tease of some of what you've been reading about stress and bird flu, and we were going to be talking a little bit about immunity, colds, flus, respiratory infections, staying healthy in the winter, and taking call-ins at 503-231-8187 in just a few minutes. But Marlena, part of what you were reading in Newsweek, I think you said...
No, it was the Wall Street Journal.
Wall Street Journal. I was talking about the don't eat eggs, don't eat... the avian flu fear.
Oh, yeah, that was in Newsweek, a big article a week or so ago, a terrifying article. Maybe it was actually around Thanksgiving, just horrible maps and terrible numbers and telling people not to eat poultry and to avoid eggs and all those kinds of things. Just an insanely scary article.
Sort of a doomsday, worst-case scenario.
Followed by the story in the Wall Street Journal this week, page one story where they do their real news. Anthony Fauci, the head of NIH, is taking money meant for bioterror medicine, that is to protect us in some kind of bioterrorist event, and giving it to startup companies at his own discretion. A very interesting story.
And do these startup companies have a strong relationship with the Heritage Foundation, or do they have a strong relationship with medical graduate research?
That's a big one right there.
That's probably where the next investigation is going to go, because there seems to be a little logic outside of scientific logic of how monies are being distributed. And the logic, as I see it, says going into the pockets of our friends and not necessarily going out to protect the public. We certainly see, as we saw Congress extending some great discounted taxes to that 0.2% of the super wealthy to the tune of over $50 billion yesterday, and last week removing food stamps and care and taking people off of Medicaid, Medicare, Medicaid status, to me, the doomsday is more how our infrastructure is breaking down than what the potential risk of the bird flu is. But we were just going to start with a couple comments about bird flu and then talk about stress and immunity and what is the difference between a cold and a flu. The avian flu that has people most concerned is labeled the H5N1, and as we mentioned on a show focusing this 2 months ago, it's a type of flu that attaches to protein structures and has a high mortality rate, killing a lot of people who get this strain of the flu from direct contact with chickens or poultry products or birds that are infected. The fear is that there will at some point become a human-to-human contagion component to this virus, and that if that happens, particularly with our air travel and narrowed borders, that we could see an epidemic, pandemic, and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or millions of people dying as a result of this. This is something we need to keep an eye on. And as you mentioned, Marlena, Japanese studies have shown that Tamiflu has really much less appropriate hope and faith in this particular condition and in flus in general than we might be led to believe, and why I mentioned a month ago that Bush's recommendation that each state shell out about $10 million to put Tamiflu on their pharmacy shelves for this year is probably not the wisest investment. We will have societal change if this happens, but the main thing I want to just say to people, you know, there is no reason to be stupid in life. We know some of the things that we need to do to stay healthy, to live well, and we, most of us, particularly if you're in the second half of life, as I probably am, have learned what some of the mistakes that we've made cost in regards to rest, stress, and general health. And so if things come to the forefront, you know, it just calls on us to reflect a little bit more to our inner wisdom. It is not something that we should be shaking in our shoes about right now. We will probably not be the epicenter of the emergence of this flu here in Portland, meaning that the first cases of human-to-human contact are probably not going to happen in the Portland metropolitan area. We represent a very small percentage of the humans on this planet here in this little valley, and we will probably have great advance notice if and when this occurs. This is potentially just one more of those many distractions from some of the important issues that we need to address in our country. And our previous show talked a lot about civil liberties and the Patriot Act. We've had the arrest of six or seven, quote, eco-terrorists today. And there is the distraction that allows us to not recognize that the military doesn't tell us how many sorties they drop in Iraq. When Marlena and I were cutting our teeth in news and social history in the Vietnam War, every day the Pentagon would talk about how many tons of bombs we have dropped. One base alone in Iraq has dropped over, I believe, 600 million pounds of bombs. It is incredible what we're doing to the environment with our daily bombing in Iraq, and it's not being reported. Unfortunately, I think every one of us in America sort of have to consider ourselves as eco-terrorists for what we are doing to this planet in allowing and tolerating the advancing of this recklessness.
Stephen, can I offer a note from the latest New Yorker on
sure.
that very story? John Murtha, the representative, Democratic rep from Pennsylvania, who's close to the Pentagon, who mm-hmm. has long been supported by militarists but has taken a turn.
Mm-hmm.
Cy Hirsch in the latest New Yorker reports that Murtha is reporting that the number of attacks in Iraq has increased from 150 a week to more than 700 a week in the past year. Estimates 50,000 American soldiers will suffer.
That is our cost, and the attacks represent the degree of pain that goes on in Iraq. But what I was talking about is the underreporting that we are continuing to drop huge bombs that are thermally and humanly and just devastating to the integrity and health of our planet. And then we're talking about drilling up in Anwar and continuing this insanity and standing by the side. And it makes one reflect whether the discussion about this administration's positioning for Armageddon isn't part of what's going on. But I really don't, I don't think that, even though a lot of the people that support this administration believe in the rapture, that the administration is looking towards creating the Armageddon. I think they're looking towards how they can profit and make the most money and somehow think that they will have the high ground when our country has to pay the costs of this continued borrowing that our nation is doing from other countries to support the costs of our infrastructure. This is talking about bird flu. So when we get to that component, we would like to see some change and get some money and energy put back into hard science from the Centers for Disease Control and National Institute of Health. We'd like to see some improvements in the U.S. Department of Agriculture and how we house and care for animals. But really, my message right now is just keep that dial tuned and don't get too enthralled and too pulled into the doomsday and the fear components. Once this emerges, we will have a glut of discussion of what we should do. And I think what we're going to see is that people are going to have to start staying home and trying to miss the bullet if this passes through our region. And that's going to make a tremendous change. Schools will be closed. People will be isolated. They'll be quarantining. We'll try to keep vulnerable people away from exposure. And a lot of people are going to have to go home and stay with their children and not work. We're going to see decreased productivity. We're going to see decreased GNP. There are a lot of things that could be costly, and it may not mutate. We may have nothing but stories to talk about what ifs. So, you know, at this point, I think we can sit back here and say, what can I do to stay healthy? And just wait and see what happens. It may mutate this year. It may mutate next year. It may mutate in 5 years. It may not mutate at all. So I think we got plenty of times to not make ourselves susceptible to too much undue stress on fearing what might happen in the worst-case scenario of the bird flu. Leave it to the scientists, to the public health people, to hopefully get some degree of sound and sane plan for how to deal with this and how to reduce the potential of this being as devastating. What is the difference between a cold and a flu and other respiratory infections? A cold is generally going to stay focused in the respiratory system. The respiratory system being the sinuses and the throat for the upper respiratory system and the trachea, bronchi, and rest of the lungs for the lower respiratory systems. Colds are often initiated by sneezing, by irritability, by drainage. They can include some of the immune response to them that we associate with the symptoms of flus, meaning it is possible to get achy muscles, to get a fever, to have other problems. But typically, colds stay and radiate in the respiratory systems and are generally of a fairly short-lasting nature, although dependent upon what you do and how you respond to it, they can last for a week or two. Typically, they're going to be of a shorter course. A flu is defined as an infection of a particular category of viruses, those that belong to the influenza groupages, and they, as I mentioned, 2 months ago, there are a number of types of flus, some that affect the respiratory system, some that affect the gastrointestinal system. Some flus and viruses will affect both of these. So generally, a flu is going to have a higher level of fever, of response, of achiness, of malaise, lower energy. It may indeed involve gastrointestinal problems, loose stools, diarrhea, nausea, vomiting. It depends on the particular brand, strain, and your own response to it. But a flu is defined by the agent of action. And what complicates this is that a lot of people are really quick to say, oh, I had the flu because they were achy. And they didn't have it cultured, and they don't know if they did. And it may have been a cold. It may have been a flu. And it may have been that third category, infections of other causes, because we can have pneumonias, bronchitises, gastroenteritises, diarrhea, vomiting, all of these things from bacterium, from viruses that are not in these categories. So typically, when you start to feel bad, you want to lessen your stress, get home, drink plenty of fluid, stay warm. watch the course of the illness and seek medical attention for diagnosis or for response should the disease progress and last for a long period of time. Temperature is an important function of the immune system, so we like to advise you not to immediately go to an antipyretic, something that lowers the temperature, like an acetaminophen, Tylenol, aspirin, those sorts of things, because that weakens the ability of your immune system to respond quickly and efficiently to the system. If the fever is in the range of 99 to 101, that's a moderate amber alert increase in your immune system. If it's between 101 and 103 to 104, that's a red alert. That means your immune system is activated to its highest level. When fevers exceed 104, that generally is a warning that you need to go into the hospital and get some degree of care. You need to cool yourself down. There is no scientific evidence that those additional degrees help the immune system function, and it is generally considered in my profession to be a sign that the body doesn't have the ability to do this on its own. So in a nutshell, that's a brief delineation between a cold and a flu, and then we want to talk about stress and immunity and staying healthy in this season. And as I start this topic, I'll put out that whatever topic you want to talk about on this show, we're open to all callers, whether it's in the health region or any area. We're at 503-231-8187. Stress in the immune system. Stress is defined as a condition that motivates a response by an organism or an agent. For example, wind can stress a tree and make a stronger tree because it has to resist and tonify itself, just as stress of lifting weights can make stronger muscles and make us stronger in general. Stress in the human body has been identified with a number of physical, biochemical, and emotional changes that take place within our body as a response to stress. Stress is a lot like the proverbial straw that breaks the camel's back. There is an accumulative weight of stress as we continue to have negative or stimulatory things occur in our life. Cold weather, just as Baby It's Cold Outside started this show. Cold weather is a stress. Wind is a stress. The acupuncture call it fang and talk about particular care to protect the midriff, the abdomen, and the neck from the evils of the cold wind. So the scarf, the wearing the proper clothes, that's a very important component for this season, is to be sensible and wear layers so you can take the clothes down to a different level as you go into the highly heated buildings, so you can wrap them back up as you go out into the cold. But the main first stage response of stress is the release of adrenaline, norepinephrine, which is what we consider to be the sympathetic or fight or flight neurologic response. Adrenaline has a number of direct first stage actions that change the way our body maintains itself. One of the things that adrenaline does is it triggers a change of energy in the body's whole system to take blood and energy away from the digestive system, the immune system, and the skin to put it into the brain and muscles. We are talking about short-term survival. You fall off a cliff, you break a leg, you release adrenaline and cortisol, and you somehow manage to limp home where you can repair and be safe from the elements and the risks that are out there in the real world. You face a barking dog. All of a sudden, you are significantly stronger and quicker of feet and quicker of thinking, and have these chemical changes. They're great on that momentary change, but on the chronic basis, since we are pulling energy from the immune system and the digestive system, there is a heavy cost. Another thing that adrenaline does is it prolongs the life expectancy adrenaline pushes sugar into the cells throughout the body, so you've got more cell energy. And adrenaline is promoted by caffeine products. So that if we're under stress and we say, gee, I'm really getting exhausted, we don't have the rebound, and you drink a lot of coffee, you're actually magnifying that weakening energy to the digestive system and the immune system. And first and second cousins to coffee include black teas and chocolates, but coffee is the most profound in this influence. There is a change of neurochemicals, and there is a change and reaction of endorphins and enkephalons, mediating chemicals and pain relievers in the body with stress. When people get in a severe accident, typically they release so much cortisol that they don't feel the pain for 1 to 2 days that they're going to feel on day three. And that's hopefully going to allow people to find an avenue towards safety. But it is a reminder that our own internal chemicals are hugely powerful, that they are stronger than any prescription drugs we have, and that they are influenced by what we're exposed to and how we think. There have been studies done in the past. There was a very interesting study in the past where students were given adrenaline to see how they responded to it, and half of the students were criticized by the interviewing nurse before the study. She or he would say something like, gee, I've got some breath mints in my room if you'd like me to go get some. And, you know, I've got hair like yours, and I finally found somebody who knows how to cut it. I'd be happy to give you their card. Just a little emphasis of criticism versus the opposite of the interviewee saying, gee, I love your clothes. Could we maybe go shopping sometime? And, wow, I love your hair. Maybe you can help me out. And those little things, the people that were complimented with the intake of adrenaline felt increased energy, increased happiness, euphoria. People who were criticized were tearful, were sad, were depressed, had low energy, and it was the exact same chemical. So how we respond to what stimulates us in our life is profoundly involved in what that stimulation does to our physiology. People who are type A, constantly on the run, rarely say no to anything that's asked of them. If they love what they're doing, they're healthy. If they resent it, they have increased heart disease and increased health problems. So it is very important as we deal with the stresses of the darkening days, of the cold, of the increased exposures, of the traffic congestion, of the holiday madness, of the malls, of the expectations, of the family meetings, all of these things that add straws to that load of stress that we have, it is a great time to reflect, to meditate, to look at yourselves and your own response and see if there's something that you can do to take a different attitude, need a new attitude about the way we respond. Do we really want the erratic behavior, the quote, stress of others to be impacted and chiseled in stone into our own biochemistry? Or do we want to be mindful, be watchful, be responsive when we need to be, but learn to let go of more of what is going around? So staying healthy is an important component throughout the year, and particularly as we look at the risks of infectious disease and as we look at aging. New report that we're now older than ever in America. We've got our longest life expectancy, but we've had a substantial increase in the number of adults between 55 and 65 with obesity and high blood pressure. We may actually, in spite of the heroic aspects of medicine, if we have money for medicine in 10 years, we may actually see our life expectancy reducing as we age more of the people who ate poor food, had an overuse of chemical treatments, had some of the agricultural limitations that exist from the corporate production of foods that are not nearly as nourishing as those which we have historically had on this planet. Reducing stress can be done through meditation, through thought. It can be done through exercise. It is a hard time for a lot of people to get out there early and jog in this really cold weather. It maybe isn't the right thing to do. There's mall walking. There's finding equipment at home for you to get aerobic exercise at home. There are a lot of activities that we can do during the winter, either dressing well for or responding to. But the more we exercise, increase the blood flow, burn off that adrenaline, because exercise has been shown to reduce adrenaline in our system, the better we are going to respond to this stress. B vitamins, antioxidants, essential fats, there's a wide array of nutrients and supplements that help us, and you'll typically find in health food stores B100 supplements that have 100 milligrams of B1, B2, and B3, and a wide array of other things that are utilized under high stress, like vitamin C, vitamin E, B6, pantothenic acid, as that one, B12, or cyanocobalamin. So there are nutrients that we can help to deal with stress. Sometimes we need to turn the cheek and turn around and move the other direction. We don't have to joust with every windmill that comes into our life, and that's more of that attitude. Take the higher ground. As we go into the winter solstice and we come to the shortest day of the year in just 12 days on the 21st of December, it is a lot like a new moon. It is a lot like that darkest time. It is the tradition of the seasons ending and unfolding to start again. It is the seed planted into the ground to bring forth in the spring. This is a time right now that is particularly relevant to reflection. To reflect is an interesting word and concept. You can reflect a light off of a mirror or a shiny object, bounce it back. Reflection is to reveal something that's unseen, like looking in your rearview mirror. You look at yourself in the mirror and you see yourself, but when you reflect internally, instead of bouncing off, you go deeper. And from that standpoint, the term reflection in the dictionary or reflect means to meditate or to reveal a revelation of what you find. It is a time to reflect on how we have lived and how we want to live, to look at what we know and what we've done and see if there are some things that we can change to be more productive and more healthy in our attitude and our outlook and our activities in life. It is not that much of a coincidence that New Year's Day, December 1st, is a time when people make resolutions to try to make changes in their life, often spurned on by a New Year's Eve party and a hangover, and more of a reactive response. And that's why I say now is a good time to reflect, because we're coming up through a very important holiday season of a number of world religions. We've got the solstice, we've got Kwanzaa, Hanukkah starts on the 25th this year, we've got Christmas. It is a time where we are gathered together inside of houses, where we have to face the demons of our judgments on our family and friends and either be compassionate and forgiving and let go and move on and create a new day, or hold on to the same old, and live for another year of resentment and holding that stress in our body. So I think it is a great time to reflect. And we would like to take your calls. We're at 231-8187. Did you have a comment, Marlena?
Caller.
Oh, hi. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, sorry. I hope this isn't too far off your topic. But about the first half of this year, I worked at the back room of a store that was quite dusty. And sure enough, I got sick about 4 months into working there. And I didn't think much of it, except I had an unusual amount of mucus and phlegm. And that went away for the most part. But it actually, the phlegm and the mucus, I don't know if those are interchangeable terms, but I can still bring it up. And I feel fine. You know, I have no symptoms of actually being sick, and I still have pretty good energy. But man, the stuff just won't stop coming, and it doesn't come from coughing it up. I can just sort of feel it there, and I can bring it up, and I have to spit it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I also... Before you continue,
what type of dust, what environment? Is this sawdust?
It was old clothing and, you know, stuff that had been donated from houses.
Okay.
So a lot of dusty old junk.
Sure.
And it was too late. I finally got wise and used a mask, but by then it was too mm-hmm. late. So, I don't feel sick. It's still, the mucus is still coming up. And since it's been cold, my nose is running an unusual mm-hmm. amount. So I'm just curious what you think about that or have any thoughts.
Well, God has blessed the human body. It is remarkable that we can put up with what we're exposed to. We have little cilia in our lungs. If we're not a heavy smoker or around a lot of harsh chemicals, we've got little hairs in our lungs that act actually like little escalators to help lift the mucus and the debris out of the lungs. We have in our lungs not only the bronchioles, the cells that involve exchanging oxygen for carbon dioxide to keep us alive, but we also have mucus cells that act as, we might consider it, although it's much more viscous than our garden hose, as a way to wash off the sidewalk. We have these mucus cells that produce mucus when stimulated, and this mucus will carry out debris. And in this case, the exposures that you have around this household dust may have involved mites and bacterium. It may have involved molds and fungi. It may have some degree of replicability. It hopefully didn't involve things like sawdust and asbestos, which are much more potently damaging to the lungs. Sawdust recently accepted as a carcinogen, telling people that sawing lumber without a respirator is not necessarily a good daily activity for you to be involved with. Mucus production will continue as long as there is irritation to that area. So you probably, I don't know if you continue to inhale dusts, but there's probably some functional component. And this is where something like a slippery elm, marshmallow root, or licorice root to help the expectoration or an expectoration formula might help you get through the curve. When we think of lung stress, we think strongly about beta-carotene as being a strong natural supporter of lung function, essential fats. We also think of the herb turmeric as being a particularly good herb for the lungs and one that you might want to have on hand for those colds and flus because it's been shown to be a really good, safe spice or herb for infections of the lungs. So dairy and wheat often increase mucus production because, according to the Ayurvedic and other people, when you incompletely digest foods, your body pushes it out the mucus cells and we get more mucus production. And a lot of people see this almost instantaneously with a big cheese meal. So you can increase fluid, increase fiber, get the antioxidants in, consider the lung herbs, use the respirator, decrease the exposure, and help to promote the completion of this cycle. But it can take time to totally clear out those deep recesses of the lungs and stop the mucus production. So I'm going to take another caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I was wondering about vitamin D3. If 2,000 units is a good standard dose, is that both a maximum and a minimum, and is that year-round? Or could I add, maybe another couple of thousand units, or would that be advised? And also one other question about sinus infections.
Sure. Give me the other question, and then
I'll answer
both of them.
Chronic sinus infection that just doesn't go away.
Yeah.
It seems to date back to when I took some antibiotics.
Absolutely.
And I was wondering, like olive leaf extract, delenolate, oregano, what can I do for that?
Okay. So, the second question first, the Mayo study of 4 years ago found that 95 or 96% of adults with chronic acute sinusitis that was caused by fungi, which is stimulated by antibiotics, but 95% of the time in conventional medicine, sinusitis is treated with antibiotics, which relieve symptoms but promote the chronicity and the virtual guaranteed return. So when we talk about sinus, there can be, there have been studies recently done that show that the neti pots with saline water can be good rinsing agents. There are some nice homeopathic pumps that can help to lubricate and keep things from being inflamed. But we generally think of the antifungals, things like garlic, a berberine, which comes from Oregon grape and golden seal, and a number of other antifungals that are associated with it and high fluid intake. So that would be the answer to the sinusitis as I was first look at it, is consider it fungal, not bacterial, virus is most probable. Decrease the high sugar foods, which include white flour, white rice, white potatoes, sugars, alcohols, those sorts of things. Increase the fluid and some of those same slippery herbs to help decongest, which is marshmallow root, slippery elm, licorice are some of the most commonly available ones there. On ISO D3 or D3, recent studies have shown that vitamin D has been underestimated at its importance in the broad aspect of health, that it's not just associated with bone integrity and the deposition of calcium and magnesium, but it's associated with mood, with depression, with the development of cancer, with cardiovascular concerns. And so there is now the ongoing debate that the sun actually prevents more cancer than it ever causes. And we've got the researchers and the dermatologists squaring off, because the dermatologists want us to use these sunscreens, which, as we've used sunscreens in American life, we've seen dramatic increases in skin cancer. So we wouldn't generally think that that is a good record for their recommendations. There are people like Trudeau's book that says that, and he quotes a study that came out of Europe, that five of the most common used agents in sunscreens are all carcinogens and cause cancer. So we've got this debate. No, we don't want to get second and third degree burns from the sun, but the normal amount of vitamin D in our diet does not affect the physiologic and biochemical positive responses that sunlight of a short degree of exposure would provide. 2,000 units of vitamin D3 is basically what they considered to be the ideal dosage for recognizing the benefits of sunlight conversion without exposure to sun to help protect against cancer, help with mood, those sorts of things. We do not have in D3 a belief that if we were to do 4,000 that we would have a toxic response, and less is probably less effective. Nonetheless, the early stage of research says that 2,000 is a pretty good dosage and can be done 365 days a year. However, if you are someone who gets out into the sunlight on a regular basis and you are getting that exposure, you are creating your own vitamin D. So it's related. It's definitely something that would be strongly indicated in Oregon during the winter, but maybe we don't need to supplement from June to September if we're getting in our shorts and getting out there doing some yard work or taking care of some activities.
Stephen, can Marlena. I make a comment?
Mm-hmm.
My primary care provider, naturopathic physician, recommended, because I'm an older person with, you know, achy joints, et cetera, that I increase my omegas, but also that I start taking cod liver oil. Now, isn't that A and D?
Excuse me.
Bless you, child. Cod liver oil, and that, I've noticed a difference in my overall sense of health with that cod liver oil. So can you mention cod liver oil?
Cod liver oil can be A and D. It can be DHEA and eicosapentaenoic acids. There are various constituent blends of cod liver oil. But yes, very definitely. That's one of the oldest sources. I remember when Lloyd Center first opened, they had their health ways with the crazy old ladies, as I used to think they were before I became one of them, sort of wrong gender, but some of those same health food store type of people. And they had their cod liver oil, and it was strongly recommended. And back in my teens, I used to actually take that. I wasn't forced to. I just believed in it, and it is a good source of those vitamins.
Well, those of us who grew up in the Northeast, that was a standard. All the kids were getting cod liver oil. I think we have another caller on the air.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I just finished reading one of the most amazing books that I've ever read. It's called Detoxification and Healing, by Sidney McDonald Baker, medical doctor. And I believe that he said, I could be wrong, but I believe he said that oil fat is the most essential nutrient for the human body, and that the adulterated oils are extremely harmful, and that it's almost universal that people are omega-3 deficient.
But so I just want to mention that book to the listeners, anybody that might be interested. And also, you know, for medical practitioners like yourself, might want to read it. But my question is, I do some sautéing on low heat, generally just garlic and onions for miso soup. Is heating the cold-pressed organic oils that I buy, is that how harmful is that, if at all?
Okay. I haven't read this particular book, Detoxification and Healing by Baker. I have been talking about the omega-3, omega-6 deficiencies in patients for the 18 years I've been on KABU. We consume 30 to 40% fat in the American diet and under the 4.6% required to maintain health of the two essential fats, the omega-3 and omega-6. And for our listeners, that means a double bond on the third carbon and a double bond on the sixth carbon, which are the two double bonds that are necessary. And the heat omega-6 oils are essential, meaning we have to consume some of them or we get sick and eventually will die prematurely or have significant worsening of our health. Polyunsaturated oils are the oils that we find these omega-3 and omega-6 oil fats in. And they need to be cold pressed, as our listener responded to, because the heat extraction destroys these and creates the trans fatty acids that are associated with such dramatic progression of disease and the development of Western diseases in a number of different studies and cultures that we've seen them in. So heat extraction causes these trans fatty acids. Hydrogenation causes these trans fatty acids. And heating at temperatures above sunlight, because these two essential fats, omega-3 and omega-6, are the two fat structures that plants use to convert sunlight into plant energy. So they are volatile with the sunlight and ultraviolet exposure. So these protective oils need to be in opaque or dark containers. They need to be stayed. They need to be kept below that 90 degrees that will stimulate the reactive change, and they cannot be cooked at 200 degrees or 300 degrees. If you use rapeseed or canola oil or safflower oil or corn oil, even if they're cold pressed, and you fry with them, you are creating a toxin. Typically, the most commonly referred to oil for sautéing is olive oil, which is 96% oleic and palmitic acids, which are 16 and 18 carbon fats with one double bond in the middle of their structure, and when the heat breaks that, it's saturated. It doesn't have any trans fatty acids. There is 1.2% linolenic acid in olive oil, so there is a small degree of trans fatty acid, about 0.6% trans fatty acid production, which is what you'd get from one potato chip. But some people wouldn't even eat that one potato chip. So olive oil is considered pretty darn safe. However, the safest oils to cook with would be an organic coconut or an organic palm oil, and that's because they are totally saturated. There isn't even that 0.6% conversion into the trans fatty acid. I know that my local co-op, of which I'm a member, Peoples, does carry organic coconut oil, and I have it in a Genesis cooler at my office just to provide for people. So if you're ever, now I've never made a donut, but I understand you have to fry them in oil. If you ever want to deep fry something, then you'd want to use a coconut oil for it. It's a little sweet, but it's one of the only oils that is stable. And you want it to be organic. You want to make certain that it hasn't been highly sprayed, because most of the toxins that we're concerned about are what we call lipophilic or fat-loving. So oils that are produced in fields with a lot of pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, and chemicals can be saturated with some of these fat-binding chemicals that can stimulate really bad changes. So I think it's very important. I have for over 20 years suggested most of my patients supplement a tablespoon of flaxseed oil as a fairly inexpensive form. We're now seeing if there's a higher level of inflammation, I look at a high-quality fish oil to supplement on top of that to just give a little increase of the omega-3 and reduction of that inflammation. Raw sunflower oil is another good source of essential fats, but again, cold press, not cooked. Good question, listener. So we are coming towards the end of another day. We've got 5 minutes left, so let's take this caller and see how we want to end, and we'll be back in 2006. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes. I have a question about niacin, and I've been taking 3 grams a day for many years, and no problem. That's straight niacin. And also taking an excellent multi with all the bees. Should I be increasing other bees to complement the 3 grams?
I don't know. There's my voice back. I guess Marlena thought I was going to get another dust sneeze here and was trying to protect you from that loud noise.
Yeah.
3 grams is a pretty potent dose of niacin. And niacinamide is the form that people generally recommend if you're going to dose that high, but that comes from a few studies on niacin's reduction of cholesterol and a synthetic time-release niacin resulting in inflammation of the liver.
Right.
And so if you're taking 3 grams and every once in a while you do a chemistry profile,
yes,
and
I
you
do
see
every 3 months.
No liver inflammation, then
no.
You're doing exceptionally well with that.
Right.
And water-soluble vitamins typically are handled without much problem.
Okay.
B6 is the one area that we have a neuropathy, and B6 has always been given in the microgram versus the milligram dosage. That's where it was discovered for its essential lead link to health. And when it was discovered back in the late 70s to reduce the swelling of carpal tunnel, some doctors went from 100 micrograms to 6 grams.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be equivalent to you're doing 30 to 60 grams of niacin. There was some degree of nerve degeneration, but it was such a heroic leap. So there are levels. We don't want to go up to 3 grams of everything. But it would probably be wise, if you're doing that niacin, to at least have 100 milligrams of every other non-B6 B vitamin in your protocol. Well, B12 and B6 would be the 100 microgram.
And
it would be good to balance.
Excuse me, Stephen, the impact of toxifying the liver like that on the immune system would be...
Well, the liver produces the immune chemicals. It's one of the main manufacturers of the immunoglobulins that allow us to adapt and become resistant and kill off many invaders. The liver is also the heaviest area of mitochondrial activity, which is the main energy production of the body. There are just such a wide array of things when you inflame the liver that you see diminishing in the quality of life. A lot of things. Hormone normalization, as the liver's inflamed, we have more reactivity to estrogen. We probably also have more reactivity to testosterone in men. Although there hasn't been as much research in what makes men angry, irritable, and hostile in liver hormonal component as there has been what makes women sad, depressed, and irritable from hormone activity of premenstrual activity and such, and led us to understand that there are 3 forms of estrogen, and when the liver is healthy, we conjugate or neutralize the estrogen so it's less impactful. So the liver is the main integrate of almost all activity of the human body, and if the liver's inflamed, nothing's going to work right.
Can we take one more call? Quickly?
We can take one more call, and then we'll be on to Justin Frank on the couch. Remarkable book and scary about who this GW was as a child. It reminds me of the kids that used to burn animals. I'll be glued to this show as I drive to work. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Yes, we were talking about oils, and I was wondering if you could tell me anything about coconut oil. You mentioned it for deep frying, but I was wondering, a naturopath recommended it to me to take just 2 or 3 tablespoons a day just to take it, and I wonder what you think about that.
Well, I don't know what you eat typically and what your intake of oil is. Nathan Pritikin showed in the Longevity Institute that people can be healthy with as little as 10% fat in their diet, although this is exceptionally boring, and we generally recommend 20% fat. We do need fat for nerve cells. We do need fat for every cell in our body. So there is a requirement for fat as a succinct entity, And for specific fats, the omega-3s, linoleic and gamma-linolenic, and some people say arachidonic acids, in exact form for the body. Coconut oil is a stable fat, as an organic form is going to give you that oil. If you aren't eating seeds or nuts or having other oils in your diet, it might be recommended for supplementing. I think 3 tablespoons of coconut oil is a lot of coconut oil to have on a regular basis. And, you know, I would choose to get more of my oils naturally from my foods than just supplementing it. But I don't know your food sensitivities. It may be that you have limitations on what your body tolerates. But again, the organic coconut oil is a pretty safe, bland source of fats for your body to do its biochemistry with, but does not contain the essential fats, so you need to supplement those 3s and 6s elsewhere. And I think that's it, Marlena. It's been a wonderful year with you again.
Really?
And I'll look forward to next year. To all of you out there, have a safe and healthy holiday season. When possible, be kind, share, be generous, be loving. Always be safe out there. This is a time when people are not necessarily navigating the roads or listening to their own inner voices about how to treat each other with love. So I wish you all the best of holiday seasons, the best of solstice change as we look forward to the returning sunlight. And I'll look forward to being with you on the second Friday of January, Marlena.
Mm-hmm.
Have a great year.
Thanks, Stephen. And to that, I would add lots of hand washing as we head into the holiday season. And, Stephen, I found this quick review of the kinds of advances we've made now that alternative health care is greater than 50% of the consumer marketplace. This is because we've gotten together and made it happen. This from Anna Mika, president of Citizens for Health at citizens.org. These are just some of the things she lists. Consumers made a difference in 1975 when we objected to Federal Trade Commission attempts to ban the word natural, organic, and health food on labeling and advertising. Decision makers listened to 1 million of us in 1976, leading Congress to pass the Proxmire bill, which prohibited the U.S. Food and Drug Administration from regulating vitamins and minerals as prescriptions. In 1994, 2.5 million of us demanded protection for health rights, and Congress passed the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act that allows us to purchase our supplements. In 1998, we encouraged regulators to reverse their position when almost 400,000 consumers contacted the USDA with an SOS to keep organic organic. The campaign kept genetically modified foods, sewage sludge, and irradiated products out of certified organic food. Recently, over 54,000 people sent letters to the FDA urging it to continue respecting their health rights and the integrity of the Dietary Supplement Health Act. And so I just wanted to let people know that there are people out there, and you're one of them, who are taking a stand and making it possible. And the reason Stephen and I are even in some ways able to be here and talk is because we as consumers, as citizens in this democracy, are involved. And I want to just say to continue that in the new year, Stephen.
And I'd just like to say, as much as I'd like to say, yeah, didn't we do great work, right now we have a Senate and Congress that would like to continue to call anything synthetic natural. We can say natural flavorings that include all sorts of chemicals. Spices can include very toxic chemicals. You want to see an actual food on the label. If you see natural ingredients or spices, you probably have some stuff that you wouldn't put on your child's skin or their clothes, let alone put in their food. So one of the most important things is to eat outside of the box and eat outside of the can and eat outside of the processed food industry.
Great.
So the more we get whole foods, the less we have to think and the more we can think and enjoy life.
Good Thanks, day. Stephen. Gotta go. It is 4 minutes after the hour. Now it's 5 minutes after the hour of 10. You're tuned to your community radio station, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 on the FM band here in Portland. I'm going to take a little musical break, and when we come back, we'll have Dr. Justin Frank.
Previously, the tension between...
Got the wrong CD there. Let's try that. Okay, that was B.B. King, and here's the thing. I just spoke with Dr. Justin Frank to make sure that we get him on the air, and what is happening is because, like so many of us, life gets fast and stressful. He is in a restaurant somewhere in New York City and is at the present moment skittering around looking for a place where he can actually, I'm sorry, I'm not as close to the mic as I should have been. There you go. He's skittering around New York City right now inside a restaurant looking for a place where he can actually do this phone call. So we're going to take a little more musical break. That was B.B. King, Merry Christmas Baby. And I think, you know, if you're listening to this kind of Christmas music, it's cool. It's not like that mall stuff. So the next one I think we'll do is Billie Holiday with Stormy Blues. Let's see if we can make the magic work. Bring that down. We have Dr. Justin Frank on the line, and I promise I will bring that up and play the whole thing later because it would be really criminal to stop Billie Holiday. Dr. Frank, are you there?
Yeah, I was enjoying it. You can keep playing it.
Well, you can go listen.
I love Billie Holiday. I was going to name my daughter Billie.
Oh, how cool.
And I had a huge fight with my wife about it because she said it's too much of a boy's name. I was going to name her Billie for Billie Holiday.
Great idea. Now, listen up here, Justin. I want to tell people something about you so the ones who don't know you will get to know you. Hold on a minute there.
Sure.
Remote psychological profiling is a tool often used in various intelligence communities to get access to the interior dynamics of individuals. This is done in order to gain mastery over their behavior and even their capacity to think. Applied, however, to an American president by a private sector psychiatrist, this technique too often creates aversion among officials, the media, and elements of the larger public. Nonetheless, the tool is value-free, hence the importance of the findings. Dr. Justin Frank is a clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry at George Washington University Medical Center. Since 1980, he has been a teaching analyst at the Washington Psychoanalytic Institute. He is past president of the Greater Washington Chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility. In a quote from a Stanford University professor, Dr. Irving Yalom, author and emeritus professor of psychiatry, You get a provision of a substantial, if brief, critique of Dr. Justin Frank, and here's the quote. An eminent and courageous psychotherapist offering us a penetrating account of the psychological makeup of the most powerful man in the world. It is compelling and persuasive and downright frightening. Close quote. Dr. Franklin is with us again from the other coast. And Dr. Franklin, again, I want to thank you for taking the time from your lunch, basically, to talk to us and welcome you back to the Electronic Salon.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back. It's funny because there's no such thing as a quiet place in New York. I come up to New York on Fridays to teach, and it's really noisy wherever you go. I hope this sounds okay.
Yeah, we're doing okay.
Good.
First quick question. Your book, titled Bush on the Couch, was published last year in 2004.
Yes.
I interviewed you prior to the election. Can you briefly tell our listeners about the methodology that you used to remotely analyze Mr. Bush and the validity of that approach?
Sure. There's a long tradition of something that's called applied psychoanalysis, and the methodology involves examining every bit of data that you can find about the person. It's usually... obviously, it's done to people who can never come into your consulting room, either historical figures or public figures, or sometimes even, those are the main two. And I essentially read everything written about him, by him. He had an autobiography, actually, by his father, two books by his mother, and then looked at all of the videotapes of his various news conferences, presentations, speeches, in great detail, paying attention to his body language, to his words, to his sentence organization. And then in looking at his history, I look at trying to apply psychoanalytic ideas and principles as a way of understanding how he got to be the way he is and what kinds of factors govern his behavior and thought.
Okay, have you noticed in his presentation any significant changes from when you first did the research for your book, Bush on the Couch?
Well, the main change I've noticed in the last few months, there's been a couple of changes. One is he looks more disheveled in general, hair longer. There's been a couple of times, in fact, there was a photograph of him signing the Rosa Parks statue memorial. And there was a close-up of that was on AOL for like a half an hour and then dropped. But in that photograph, he had a cut on his right cheek. It was quite surprising, like he had fallen. And I've noticed other little bruises and things on him. And then in his videos, he has this rotating movement of his lower jaw that he never used to have. And that started a few months ago. I think started around the time of Hurricane Katrina, or maybe when Cindy Sheehan was camped outside of his Crawford White House in Texas. But he seems more anxious and testy and in general. So I was noticing that. I think he's made a few more slips than he used to make, although he's always made plenty of slips of the tongue. That's not been, it's been fairly consistent, but I think that it's a little worse. But mainly there's things in his face and the way he moves that he just doesn't look as good. He doesn't look well.
There's been a lot of conversation in the media that he's, quote, not living in this reality. Maureen Dowd did a piece a week or so ago. His head is in the sand. He walked into a closed door in China. We're seeing him riding his bike a lot more, which may be to help with his anxiety and or to cover up any facial scarring or wounding that may come from other reasons. I'm wondering if you're noticing any of those kinds of things.
Well, I am. I'm noticing that he seems more clumsy, the walking into the door. He makes quick recoveries because he's very... I'm one of the very small minority of people who think that he's actually quite intelligent in his own way. And one of the ways he's intelligent is that he's very quick-witted. And as long as he's not confronted directly, if it's something that he's done or something that's happening to him, he can actually make a quick recovery and make a joke, which he did about the closed door in China. But it is true. He is having a lot more trouble. I also think that another reason that people exercise massively, and this, there's no clear evidence for this, but it does happen when people are trying to sweat out alcohol, if they've been drinking at all, Some people use massive exercise as a way of managing that.
Isn't it also?
It does concern me.
Isn't it also something that is related to anxiety?
Yes. One of the main things that he has done, and one of the things I write about in my book that's quite evident throughout his life, is that it's been really dedicated to trying to manage his own anxiety. And the anxiety, I think, stems from a lot of inner demons and conflicts that stem back from early childhood, with rivalries with his father, fears of his mother, guilt about his sister who died when he was 7, and then he would torture small animals when he was 9 or 10, and then did the same kind of thing to fraternity brothers when he was at Yale. And all of this, and the alcohol, started around 15 or 16. All of this was in the service of trying to control himself and manage anxiety. I think now that he's president and has stopped drinking ostensibly, there's the anxiety of being president, of having all that responsibility, plus the anxiety about whether or not he's going to drink again. People who have been heavy drinkers, who've stopped drinking, carry with them an anxiety about whether or not they're going to start drinking again. And that's why AA and other kinds of recovery programs are so important for people like that, which he does not partake of.
A lot of people in the media and in the official world, the elected world, people who make commentary, for example, on political events, seem not to understand the role of psychoanalytic insights, or not understand how you can make an observation, for example, make observations about his childhood that you can then extrapolate from and say, this is what we're seeing now because of or in relationship to something that happened earlier. I hear often in the media, I can't look inside someone's head, I can't guess someone's motives, and yet in this business, that's what you do, right?
That's what I do, and that's what I've done with him. And one of the things that has been so startling about this book, for people who really have read it and pay attention to him, is that it's been like, as a couple of people have said, it's like a playbook for how he's behaved since the book was written. Every single thing I write about, he's continued to do, living outside the law, denying responsibility, being indifferent in a way, like to the victims of Katrina, which I call malign indifference, like it's a malignant, cruel form of indifference. In fact, Congressman Kucinich said after the Katrina event that indifference is the greatest weapon of mass destruction. I mean, he understood that. There's been a lot of examples of outsourcing his cruelty, not just through Abu Ghraib, but even the Swift Boat veterans. Every campaign he's ever been involved with has involved lots of massive dirty tricks and destructiveness. And, of course, one likes to blame Karl Rove, but this is all about him. And I think that this is a long pattern that psychoanalysts, if you really pay attention to people, can really understand things. I feel like it's very clear. I feel extremely confident about the accuracy of what I've found. And a couple of biographers of his, including Kitty Kelly, who knows more about the family than any person, called me up after reading the book and were quite amazed. They don't know as much about psychoanalysis, but they were quite amazed that I could put together such a clear picture of him, and that it helped them in thinking about him and his family.
And
so I think the other thing is that you seem to be not at all worried about the fact that you're talking to a psychoanalyst, because you know I'm not analyzing you. But a lot of people, when they talk to a psychoanalyst, are afraid that the psychoanalyst is going to be analyzing them. And so they end up being self-conscious and inhibited, et cetera. And that's just not the way I am, or the way most psychoanalysts are.
So you think, right? A lot of what we hear in the media is people's fear of, or projected fear that they themselves could be victims of search for motivation.
Exactly.
Now, right. So now, just quickly, for people who still don't get it, what is it about understanding his early life that helps you make the assertions that now appear in your book, Bush on the Couch, which, by the way, has a red cover and would make a great holiday gift?
Oh, thank you. The paperback actually does, there's this paperback which does carry through with an epilogue through the early part of this year and all the way through, discusses the election and the debates and his second inauguration. I think that the main
thing to answer your question is that I look as a psychoanalyst for patterns of behavior, and that you can start to predict people, think about them, try to understand them. For example, everybody was thinking before he made his speech last week in Annapolis about unveiling a plan for Iraq. A lot of people were saying that this was going to be a new plan and a change in direction. There's just no question in my mind at the time that it couldn't possibly be a new plan, because he has to stick to the same plan. And that is based on my psychoanalytic understanding of his character and of his fear that to change plans would admit defeat and admit a mistake, and therefore would subject himself to terrible shame. He was always afraid of being shamed by his mother. So he has a swagger and a kind of confidence, and he has to surround himself by people who agree with him, because he has a lifelong history of a fear of being shamed. Nobody likes to be shamed, but his fear of that is so massive that it's quite striking. So that makes it very easy to think that he's not going to ever change course, and he certainly can't acknowledge a mistake. And it's based on a very deep-seated childhood fear. So his mother probably teased him when he was little. She was certainly tough on him. And what he learned to do was tease other people. So instead of being the victim of being teased, he became a kind of verbal schoolyard bully by the time he was 8 or 9. And he had a group of friends, all of whom were a little bit afraid of getting a tongue lashing. And we see the same thing now with the press, why the press is cowering around him, afraid of him, and they go along with whatever he says. No follow-up questions, so they don't do follow-up questions. The importance of thinking about these people, about him, enriches our way of understanding him, enriches our way of helping to think about who he is and what he's doing. I think that all public figures, and we know the least about the most important people, we know the least about our president. I think there's more personality profiles done for people who work in fast food restaurants than there is of the president. I don't know if that answers your question. But
well, I think that goes a long way to helping people understand
very important
how psychoanalytic work has meaning. One of the things that also occurred to me when you were talking is the constellation of historical pattern and contemporary behavior often
yes.
also travels with kind of bizarre, lustful, lascivious sexual behavior, and I don't know if that's a part of his component, but it certainly is one of the things that can travel with that. Is that correct?
Yes, it
yes.
can travel with it. And it's not clear what I mean, this is a man who I think preferred drink to lascivious behavior.
Okay.
Growing up.
Okay. Now, here's the next quick question. In your book, Bush on the Couch, you have a chapter called The Smirk, S-M-I-R-K.
Yes.
And in that chapter, you discuss a kind of a sadistic underlying pathology in this person.
Yes.
And I wonder if you would talk about that particularly, because what's happening is a huge amount of devaluing of life, and we're seeing that at a high level in Iraq. We certainly saw it in the Gulf. We're seeing it on a national level, and I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the roots of his sadism and how the sadistic nature, rather, because the other word sounds too...
one of the things is that in devaluing life, one can express sadism without getting the pleasure out of it. Usually a sadist enjoys inflicting pain on other people, and one of the things that that is a characteristic of somebody like that, and the roots of Bush's particular sadism, go back a long way. When his sister died at 7, there was no funeral, there was no mourning, there was no discussion about it. The parents played golf the next day. Clearly they were both sad, but there was no chance for him to work on his feelings. And what happens with somebody is that they develop almost like a separation into two people in their mind. And they become cruel towards the part of them that feels weak or needy, because what they're doing is, since Barbara Bush, his mother, said, no talk about loss, no talk about hurt, no tears, he then started attacking in his mind the part of himself
that had tears, that felt bad, that really felt sad. And so he developed a cruel attitude almost towards a part of himself, which he then put onto other people. So anybody who's weak or downtrodden or vulnerable, those are the people he attacks cruelly and savagely. And I think they all represent in his mind a part of himself. So, like, for instance, and he does it automatically. Like, I wrote about this guy named Jack Smith, who was a radio White House correspondent on the Radio Corps, and he was in one of the TV press briefings, and he said to President Bush, thank you for, I'm usually on radio, thank you for letting me ask a question. And then he asked a tough question, and Bush said, you know, you have a face for radio. I mean, he does it automatically. He'll just cut you down. And he does it without questioning. And then you can see through his path how he would torture animals and blow up frogs with firecrackers. He would shoot BB guns. I didn't even know this. That his younger brothers, when he was around 12, 13, 14, he would chase, line them up and chase them down the hall and shoot at them. Then in college, he would do all kinds of things, but as pledge master at Yale, he was even interviewed by the New York Times because there was such a scandal in 1967 that he had branded with hot coat hangers the buttocks of pledges. And you can see a direct line and a pattern of his cruelty through the smirk that he has on his face when he talks about executing somebody, when he talks about bringing people to justice, when he says, bring them on, which a lot of people in the military were shocked that he would talk like that, since he was far away and not doing anything. His pleasure at waving the gun around when they caught Saddam Hussein, and then allowing all those frightening photos of Saddam Hussein's, disgusting photos of his, you know, brutalized sons, and then the whole history of wanting to condone torture now. This is a man who has a long history of cruelty and pleasure at it. The smirk is a sign of his pleasure at sadism. Now he can express it without necessarily showing his pleasure. He can do it by outsourcing it, by getting other people to do it for him, and he can then turn his back on it. But there's a long pattern. It's very disturbing.
We're talking to Dr. Justin Frank, a psychiatrist. The book is called Bush on the Couch. It's out in paperback. It's got a lovely red cover. It would make a great holiday gift. It's an important book to understand the inner dynamics of this person who has been occupying the White House. Another question, the lying upon lying, you know, the lying liars and the lies they tell, not only Mr. Bush, but Cheney, Rumsfeld, Karl Rove, Condi Rice, all the people around him, what does the lying suggest about all of this underlying motivation?
The lying is the same thing. The lying, there's two parts to the lying. One is the evasion of responsibility, to deny responsibility. But the second lie, part of the lie, has to do with contempt for normal people like us and contempt for the truth and feeling that they're above it and outside it. And I think that he got approval for that when the Supreme Court didn't count all the votes in Florida. I mean, the Supreme Court said, okay, you can be outside the law, you can do whatever you want, and it doesn't matter. So then he breaks these treaties and breaks Kyoto Treaty and disregards things, and he has hired people to work with him who have the same attitude that he does. So he has surrounded himself with people who are very similar to him psychologically. And the lying has to do with evasion of responsibility and also contempt for the truth. Those two things.
So that Go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say that would explain the persistence of the Cheney lying.
Yes.
And the bizarre Rumsfeld.
He would only choose people who were willing to lie.
Okay.
Colin Powell got duped into lying about those tubes and everything that he made his presentation to the UN. But I think that he lied too for a while, but then he couldn't stand it anymore, and so he left.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the people who don't like to lie will leave. Or Bush will kick them out if they stand up to him and say, you can't do this. He'll say, I can do whatever I want. I wish I could keep talking. I love it, but I actually have to go back to where I am.
Okay.
Is that okay?
That's fine. Can you make a brief remark about the returning soldiers and the issue of PTSD?
Oh, my goodness. It just is heartbreaking.
If it's too big, I'll make another appointment with you.
Would you? Because I will. Heartbreaking. I my heart goes out to them, and it is heartbreaking what's happening.
Okay.
And their lives are permanently, the ones who are living are permanently shattered, and it's terrible. It's taken years for Vietnam veterans to get over it.
Okay, how's the weather in New York?
Cold.
Cold.
But clear.
Do you have your scarf and your hat and your mittens?
I have my scarf and my hat and my galoshes.
Okay, good. Stay healthy.
I will do my best, and I'd love to come back. I'm sorry about the
Not a problem.
Noise.
I so appreciate getting even a half hour. People are thrilled to hear from you, and I will call you back. And have a safe holiday, and take good care of yourself.
Thank you. You too.
You bet.
Okay.
Dr. Justin Frank, the book is Bush on the Couch. He's going to miss out on it, but you're going to get to hear Billie Holiday again, and let's see if I can make all that happen.
Thank you.
good morning blues. Blues, how do you do? Good morning blues. Blues, how do you do? Babe, I feel all right, but I come to worry you. Babe, it's Christmas time, and I want to see Santa Claus. Babe, it's Christmas time, and I want to see Santa Claus. Don't show me my pretty baby.
You, Billie Holiday, which you heard, and then I also gave you Good Morning Blues with Count Basie and his orchestra, and because I also promised I would do a little bit of Michael Mead today, I'm going to finish up the first side of Disc 1, where we're having a discussion of initiation and the soul, the sacred and the profane, Michael Mead, the mythologist and storyteller. He's going to move into the area of the Buddha and the Shilina gig today, and I just want to make a passing mention about the Shilina gig. He will describe what they are to you. They are figures that were carved into the area above doors in the old sacred stone areas where people gathered to honor their indigenous spiritual beliefs, and they were obscured by the Irish government for many years. And a woman who lived here not long ago and is now living in Ireland, an artist, her name is Fiona Moore, and she actually began to unearth them in Ireland when she traveled and started to sketch them, and that became a major force in her artwork. And so I want to give credit to Fiona for actually opening that door to the Shilina gig. So now let's go to Michael Mead and see what we can learn about the Shilina gig in Buddha.
Previously, the tension between nature and culture was held in shrines that combined both and demonstrated the underlying unity of the world. Even as going back as recently in history as to Lourdes, or going down into Mexico and seeing some of the grottos where the Guadalupe is said to have been, that you get this template which holds nature and culture together and helps resolve the tension that everybody feels. And that the loss of these kind of shrines releases that tension into the common world and makes everything harder. Ancient sites were typically neither wholly natural nor completely man-made. Barrows and stone circles, the standing stones, the dolmens, the ancient temples, and the caves were all artfully shaped out of the natural elements to make the sacred more present. Again, you go back and imagine these great stone circles and all. It's the combination. It's still compelling. People are totally compelled. They stand in line to go to Stonehenge. And when you look at it, what you're seeing is this amazing combination of nature and culture. The standing up of the stones and the making of that circle. And then people can't figure out how they did it. And you go, you know, I just can't go there without jumping over to Ireland. And going along the Boyne, you know, where the ancient tomb there And it's arranged in such a way that the sun on the morning of the winter solstice creeps right in and illuminates this three-circle spiral thing at the back of the cave. And what caused them to think of it? And the what, the how, the why is this combination of nature and culture where some epiphany occurs to someone and they have to do it. And that and those things last. Those are 5, 6, 7, 8,000-year-old structures still holding as potential shrines and ways that people could understand the world. And it shows you how enduring it is, and of course, people go there on their vacations. It's still compelling to us. Through shrines and these temples, the sacred forces are both expressed and contained. Expressed for their great healing spiritual values, contained because of their destructive, dangerous values. You see how it works? The sacred needs to be shaped so that the danger of it is contained and the beauty and healing of it is expressed or available. And so that, again, that's why the statues were on the outside. And even Notre Dame with its gargoyles is saying, this is a very sacred place, the place of the Dame, our mother, by the river, where many great energies go back and forth, and we're giving you a friendly warning. Prepare yourself if you're going in. I mean, right there, you know, you can still find it. That reminds me of another church in Ireland. You can take the tour now of the Sheilinigigs. Have you done that? You can go on a tour of just churches that have Sheilinigig. All right, so you have the churches dedicated to Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, you know, kind of the seemingly male trio. And so in a sense, you could say the Christians made it into Ireland because they kept talking about the Holy Trinity. And remember, the Irish have the Brú na Boin, at the back of which is their own Holy Trinity of the three spirals. And they said, oh, wow, you're like us. You know, you got the three thing going. Come on over. Then they got there and they said, you know, Father, Son, Holy Ghost. And the people said, Father, Son, Holy Mother. Father, Son, Earth Mother. Father, Son, aren't we going to get some of the obvious? And they said, no, we don't have that. And they said, well, then we won't come to your church. You can build it, you know, and have as much fun as you want. We're not. So the regular Irish people wouldn't enter the church. And the philosophy of it is brilliant. They said that anything that opens like that is a part of the mother. Don't you remember where you came from? Don't you think when you go to church you're going in and out of the womb of spirit? And don't you think you have to signify this apparent thing, this vaginal transitional space, by saying the feminine is present? And of course the priest said, wow, we didn't know about that. And they said, we won't come in until you acknowledge it. And they said, oh, well, how do we acknowledge it? And they said, we want a shield and a gig above the door. You know, so I'm imagining the priest has to say, what the hell is a shield and a gig? A shield and a gig is the ancient woman of the world taking hold of her lower opening and then pulling it real wide so everybody can see where they came from, and having a big smile like, this is a really good joke and you're part of it. And the priest went, oh my God. And they said, yep, unless you put that over the door, we're not coming. And so there are probably 17 churches, I think, still in Ireland, and you can go on a tour, and at the entrance of the church, there it is, and you get little replicas to take home and pass around at parties and things. And so it's a reference to the great old mother and how any sacred space is inside her. And so it's beautiful that it's still there in the Western world, and it's beautiful that that knowledge was there. What they're also doing is saying that the spiritual resides with the deeply physical. It resides with the deeply physical. The tremendous split, another split in the modern world between the mind and the body, but really the mind is really not in the brain. As Blake said, the mind is the poetic unity of a person. The mind is a spiritual presence, not a physical organ. Because in South Seas, the mind is said to reside in the larynx. And other cultures, they say it's in the heart. And other people have it in their knee. So apparently the thing is movable. But mind or spirit is found where the body is. The body, in other words, you have to take your body to the sweat lodge. You can't just send your, like, idea over there and say, you know, tell me if it was a good ceremony or not. You have to drag your clumsy old body up there and put it down on the earth and suffer, little sacrifice, right? They have to heat it up to where it's uncomfortable. That's part of the sacrifice. And then Spirit says, okay, now you made an opening and we'll come in. When we find the sacred again, we also find the body again. So here's an image of the modern world, what's happened. Imagine the huge statues of Buddha carved out of the rock cliffs in Afghanistan. Have you seen them? Unbelievable. Huge. Buddha, who advocated release from everything limited by time and space, standing in stone, carved out of the huge rock face, reaching to the height of buildings. Buddha nature and Buddha culture. Rock-hard reality and hints of the beyond. Adamant stone and the image of compassion entwined in ways that reveal an underlying, if enigmatic, unity. The Buddha says, meditate, you know, let go of everything. Most Buddhism goes in that direction. And you'll go to the void. And in the void, you pass beyond. But here's Buddha in stone, the exact opposite. Huge Buddha, stone Buddha. And so you have the Buddha nature, which is let go of everything, in the Buddha culture, which is huge stone, and it won't let go of anything until some Islamic fundamentalists come and blow the whole thing up. And now you have hard rock and gentle Buddha exploding together, and both are reduced to dust in the modern profane wasteland. Culture and nature being brought low together. History being made and history being destroyed in the same moment and through the same profane act. The actual place being destroyed and the symbolic peace being shattered. Nature and culture being separated again and driven further apart. Interesting, huh? It's a modern moment. It happened in Afghanistan just a few years ago, and I thought it was really significant when I saw it on the news. So you could say that's where we live now. We live in this exploded reality where both nature and culture are, in a sense, being destroyed. Not just because of historical forces, but because historical forces become an outwardly lived fate when the internal life of spirit, of imagination, and even of psychology are not attempted to be lived consciously. Or, the way I'm saying it, when we lose mythic sense, nothing makes sense, and everything begins to break and fall apart.
That's all we're going to have time for today. We will continue with Michael Mead. The next segment is longer than we have time to play, and so I'm going to finish out with a little more from the KABU Library seasonal music. This is the hip seasonal music. Let's go to Christmas Blues with Eric Reed.